Ankinfinity Productions presents Dystopia, Clemson Goes to Hell, Book 2 in the Fermi Project. Written by Robert Raplan, narrated by Robert Raplan, produced by Robert Raplan. Author's note, you're listening to the special preview of this book, released January 19th, 2024 at Cosine Convention. If you like what you hear, keep an ear out for the full release, which should be available in May of 2024. This is book two of a series, but book one isn't available as an audiobook yet. I promise that listening to this before you read the previous one will have negligible impact on your enjoyment. I'm actually considering reordering them, making The Thaumaturgical Man a prequel. I've learned a lot about audiobook recording while making these recordings, and it's still a work in progress. You'll hear a wide range of quality, and I'm still working on a reliable process, but I think I'm getting there. I really can't stand the sound of my own voice, so please let me know if there's anything about this recording that pulls you out of the story. You can send commentary to mythobeast@gmail.com. That's mythobeast@gmail.com. I'll look forward to hearing from you. Chapter 1. The Valley of Regrets. After a century and a half and 20,000 miles, Clemson still hadn't been able to put this place behind him. Maybe he needed to see if he'd done any lasting good for this world, or maybe he just craved an end to the story. Either way, he was drawn back to the Valley of Regrets. 800 years had passed in this world, suggesting a backslide from the Iron Age he'd built. He found the watchtower that overlooked the city abandoned. One wall collapsed where a cliff had eroded underneath it. The precipice gave him a good view of the remnant of the city that the forest had yet to whittle away. He couldn't even tell where the three-story palace used to overlook his capital. Anger and grief swelled in his chest, but he pushed it down. This is catharsis, he told himself. He'd have to learn their oral histories to find out what happened after he left. The bard he'd shared his camp with sang of the Night of Terror, when the Emperor went mad and killed thousands. But he was pretty sure there were no more than a couple hundred in the palace that night. Visions of bodies being shredded by his Deathwalker flashed through his mind. Time had boiled those memories down to burned-in certainties and gruesome dioramas. He took a deep breath and ran his hand over his bald head, promising himself some meditation in the ruins to drain the power of those memories. It wouldn't help to mull over them now. Perhaps he had been mad. He wanted to believe that his rage was a side effect of the poison they used on him, but it's also possible that years of frustration and denial burst like a dam after he'd been betrayed by those he trusted most. His thaw-mechanical mule and cart awaited him outside the tower. Statement, time, 3 hours and 20 minutes after noon. The monk's reeds clicked in homunculus nonotone. Query, find you, anything, interesting. Yes, Clemson clicked back. He gave the mule a summary of his observations, knowing that the homunculus would record what he told it on thaumaturgically coated spools of silver wire. Indriput. He climbed into the saddle and put his helmet back on. Intent, travel, we, to school. Query, Arsad, you, the machine asked. Query, play, song, me. Declined. It comforted him to travel with an entity with worse social skills than his own, but this wasn't the time. Please, discontinue banter. Confirmed, it chimed. The encroaching vegetation on the road confirmed his suspicion about the collapse of trade. Halfway down, he took a side path that led to a meadow where a partial ring of granite columns rose from a field of waist-high grass. His aqueduct ran across one side of the mountain above the meadow, its graceful stone arches showing little sign of erosion. The aqueduct was where it all started. The valley needed water, so he built an aqueduct. Simple, right? He should have never gotten into government. Maybe he shouldn't have stayed at all. When he approached the circle, he was surprised by a marble statue of himself at the far end. A corroded copper plate on the base read, Aqueous, God of Aqueducts. Not a bad likeness, and they got the embossed sigils on his pseudo-stole right. He considered his current armor, realizing that he'd need to change before anyone saw him. A synthetic braying emanated from his mule. That was the mule's warning noise. Clemson looked and listened, but didn't find anything out of place, so he walked back to the homunculus. What was that? The monk tapped a hoof on the ground, reminding him that he'd disabled commentary. Please resume banter. The mule immediately replied, Alert! Witter clearance alarm! It took Clemson a moment to remember what the alarm did, but then terror gripped him. He shouted, Imperative Emergency Protocol H! The low clearance warning for the mule's four-dimensional constructs hadn't triggered since he'd tested it. There was nothing out there. Nothing but Hellion void ships. Clemson hadn't mastered four-dimensional engineering, but he understood it well enough to hide things there. The mule detonated the explosive coupling that attached it to its cart, and the saddlebags dropped to the ground. Abandoning its semblance of the equine, its carapace expanded and ports opened, internal components shifting to and from the nominal volume. The saddle and gimbal vanished, launched into the drape volume as a machine turret swung into its place. Dread overlaid his terror when it occurred to him how long it would take him to reassemble it all. His mule could take out an entire phalanx, but he'd seen the craters made by Hellions. Most of them just amused themselves with questionable trade practices, but there were tales of roving bands that would treat civilizations like playgrounds or loot and run. Their ability to cull magic and technology from other worlds made them hazardous at best. He popped the bindings on his cart and hefted his weapon, alert for any shift in the environment. A breeze rustled the tall grass that grew on either side of the stone roadway, but otherwise all was silent. The saddle assembly startled him by reappearing in the nominal plane and crashing to the ground. Did void ships make a sound? 20 feet away and 6 feet up, an axe head faded in and fell, soon followed by a skeleton. Worn olive-green clothing materialized around it, and then the rest of a woman appeared as she dropped and rolled, keeping her halberd in hand. Hellion paratroopers? He leveled the shotgun end of his weapon at her, while four more people fell out of the sky around him. Their rumpled clothing looked to be made of natural fibers, and their pasty skin lacked the distinctive sunburnt hue of Hellions. He relaxed a little with the hope that these might not be technologically advanced supremacists. "Which of you is in charge?" he demanded. He knew they wouldn't understand him, but his tone conveyed confidence. He relied upon his helmet to hide his worry and uncertainty. A woman to his right, tall and dark-haired, wearing a baggy shirt and pants with a muted green and brown floral print, replied something like,
"Amalgus Garfungaloops Rix,"
while pointing a tube at him. Pain flared in his head as the gift of tongues made room for their language, but he maintained an angry scowl and held up a finger, stating,
"You aren't going to understand this, but I have to keep you talking until I learn your language."
The tall woman growled something to a short, light-haired man wearing denim and plaid. As the man replied, their language coalesced in Clemson's mind and comprehension of their previous statements spilled in.
"Are you the builder? I thought you said he'd know our language."
"Maybe you can get your own intel next time." They weren't speaking Hellion tradespeak, but still couldn't be mistaken for friendly. "Who are you? And what do you want?" he demanded in their language.
The short man shot an energetic ha at the woman. She ignored him and addressed Clemson.
"You're definitely the builder. We need your brain."
"I'm using it." The shorter woman scowled.
"Not that brain, the mechanical one."
"I'm using that one too. You'll have to answer my questions. What problem is the brain going to solve for you?"
Their lax posture and poor discipline ruled out any organized military.
"And while you're at it, tell me where you stole the void ship."
The woman exchanged worried glances with her compatriots, and then everything went to hell, figuratively speaking. A loud crack behind him heralded a spike of pain in his left shoulder. He blew a hole through the woman in front of him while falling out of the way of what came next. The crack of the mule's railgun told him that the mule had just eliminated whoever'd shot him. Clemson rolled onto his back, agony engulfing his shoulder. The short woman raised her halberd, but before she could bring it down, a blue-green bolt split his vision, leaving an afterimage of a blinding ray of light passing through the woman's exploding head. The tall woman yelled, "Assholes!" and ran away. An amorphous white blob materialized around his mule, enveloping it. Clemson used his weapon like a crutch to push himself to his feet. The two remaining not-really-Hellions ran towards the blob. Blue-green bursts lit the blob up from the inside, and bolts cut an arc through the air, blowing the remaining man in half, but stopping after 5 shots. This worried Clemson. The gun should have worked for at least 20. The bubble must be gumming it up. The ground shook, and a shockwave blew past him. Dozens of white cords extended from the bubble to where a ripple shattered the air. A metal box the size of a small barn materialized at the other end of the cords, with an entrance like a hangar door. The remaining attacker jumped into the hangar and the cords dragged the bubble along the ground. Clemson limped to his cart, his shoulder shooting pain through him with every step. No running for him. Blood dripped from his limp left hand. The leather strap that secured his toolbox to the cart resisted his clumsy one-handed effort, so he dug for a machete. An orange explosion burped a hole from the inside of the bubble, but it collapsed back in. A secondary explosion lit up the mule from the inside and it stopped struggling. Damn, the maximum force protocol worked against him. Clemson flopped his weapon atop the chest and fired buckshot across the edge of the blob.
Bits of white goo flew off, but he couldn't sever enough cords to matter. He dropped his weapon and found the machete. The best he could do with the injured shoulder was a weak trot, and the strands dragged the homunculus across the ground faster than he could move. The hangar door closed before he could reach it, and the big metal box faded from the nominal plane.
He collapsed to his knees, spots crowding his vision. Pulling off his helmet, he puked into the grass and cursed in three languages.
Damn them.
Survival first, he reminded himself. Nobody would be coming to his rescue. He harnessed his anger to drag himself back to his cart and used the machete to slice his tool chest free of the cart. He wished he'd thought of that before. With a whistled command, the chest lid popped off and sprouted six limbs. He ordered the trunk monkey to help him out of his armor. The shot had shattered his alchemically hardened wooden backplate and punctured his molten polymer gambeson. Although the gift of vigor had already staunched the bleeding,
he had to use the monk's remote vid feed and an unhealthy dose of alcohol to pick the leaden splinters from his cracked scapula. Each of the three gifts had a downside. The flip side of vigor was that most children of the gifts died violently. He healed quickly, didn't age, didn't have to worry about infection, was difficult to poison, and even dealt well with sleep deprivation. But this didn't leave many ways to die. Wanderlust, connected to the gift of passage, ensured that he didn't spend much time in the company of friends, and the sympathy that came with the gift of tongues made violence inevitable. The sun dipped to the horizon by the time he'd finished tending to his shoulder,
so he had to drag his cart to the fire pit in front of his statue, cursing the not-actually-Hellions the entire distance. How had they known about the thaw-mechanical brain housed in the mule? What use could they have for it? Didn't they know about the mule's weaponization? Maybe it was the weapons themselves they were after.
Adrenaline aftermath kept him awake while the trunk monkey built a fire and prepared dinner, but blood loss and alcohol made the world spin dangerously. He had to keep moving and stay awake until he could get some food into him, so he dragged the 3 2/2 bodies back to the camp and looted them. In between bites of ham sandwich, he found polygonal coins, wallets, papers, and an odd collection of cards, all showing the regularity of automated manufacturing. He also found a couple of metal and glass bricks, no more than a half inch thick. When he pressed a button on a brick's side, the glass lit up like a vid display, except in color, its surface covered in clusters of videograms that he didn't recognize. He'd have to crack one open after his arm healed.
In the flickering firelight, anger sizzled under his calm exterior.
They didn't just take his transportation. They took the culmination of the past century of tinkering and research, an artificial mind spanning 15 hyperlayers of thaumaturgical perceptron matrices, approaching human mental capacity while having access to a modular set of intelligences, sensors, and devices. Everyone needed a hobby. By stealing his hobby, they'd made an epic mistake. Now he needed a new one. If they could travel between worlds without portals, so could he. A flicker caught his attention. A brief reflection from a bit of metal beyond the dome of light created by his campfire. Crisp lines of fancy robes faded in from the shadows. Clemson considered grabbing a weapon, but he'd already exhausted his ammunition, and he was in no condition for a fight. Fortunately, the figure wasn't dressed for conflict. The hemline wouldn't survive a walk in a park, much less rough conditions an hour's walk from the local approximation of civilization. The robes resolved into a feminine form, slender but still curvy. The fabric resembled red oak but flowed like silk instead of the rubbery drape of alchemically softened wood. She carried a walking stick instead of using it. At first he thought the color of her skin was an artifact of the firelight. When she drew close, he realized that her face really was a vibrant, unnatural crimson. Black silky hair hung shoulder length, framing her distinctly Hellion angular bone structure. Clemson played up his exhaustion.
"Have you come to finish the job?" The woman stopped on the other side of the fire and smiled.
"I think you're mistaking me for someone else. Do you need help?"
She spoke in Panthropolian, so she must know who he was. Clemson wouldn't put it past a Hellion to stab someone so they could sell him a bandage.
"Not if it isn't free." "Well then, do you mind if I sit?"
Her delicate lilt and soft trilling felt like essence of lullaby, but rapid instead of slow.
Clemson offered a large log to his right, but the woman flourished and her walking stick unfolded into a stool. "Nice trick."
"I'm afraid I have you at a disadvantage."
She sat and crossed her long legs.
"I've been following your career since you built this thing."
She gestured upward at the arch of the aqueduct, flickering red in the glow of firelight.
"I have a career."
Unbidden memories washed over Clemson.
"Why would you bother having me followed?"
"I don't have you followed. I just buy reports from your biggest fans."
Do you have any idea how well the Chronicles of the Children of the Gift sells on Hellion markets? I purchased the right to your histories after the first book, but if I hadn't, someone else would have.
Even it up for me a little. Who are you?
She smiled and spoke softly. Call me Victor, Baron of the Ninth Circle of Hell. Don't be too impressed. They have a lot of barons up there. I'm looking to recover a stolen cargo ship. Victor glanced at the bodies.
Victor, that's an odd name.
It isn't a name, it's a title. You wouldn't believe what I had to do to get people to call me that.
A story for another time, I'm sure. I bet you can tell me how they got hold of the ship. They didn't seem competent enough to earn it.
They were competent enough to take your homunculus.
At the cost of 4 lives.
Lives are cheap in hell. Your mechanical brain might be worth more than the ship. She held an open hand towards the corpses. May I look?
Be my guest.
Victor collapsed her chair back into a walking stick and approached the cadavers. She pulled a glass metal brick from the folds of her robe and traced patterns on the glowing glass side with a finger. A light issued from the metal side, illuminating the corpses. After digging through the clothing, she asked,
You wouldn't happen to have found one of these, would you?
She waved her brick in Clemson's direction.
I might have. What are they?
They're called GLADIGs. Compact information storage, communications, sensors, that kind of thing. It occurred to Clemson that he might be able to use Victor to retrieve his monk.
Will it help you find them?
Maybe. If one of them was receiving telemetry, I could use it to track their departure.
Would you take me along? I'd like a chance to retrieve my property too, you know.
An exaggerated look of sadness crossed Victor's countenance.
I'm sorry, but we aren't allowed to accept unbonded passengers. Would you take my word that I would return it to you?
Clemson failed to hide his affront.
I'm sorry. Do I know you? No, you have no way of convincing me. How do I avoid being an unbonded passenger?
That's not advisable.
You'd have to wear a security necklace at all times. Taking it off in any Hellion facility would be an instant death sentence. Is your machine really worth it? He had no intention of staying on the Hellion ship any longer than necessary, and knew he could cut through any collar they put on him.
It's more than just a machine to me. It has the records of the worlds I passed through to get here. I might never find my way back home without it.
Clemson watched his trunk monkey add more wood to the fire and felt a wash of sadness.
It's also the closest thing I have to a friend, he mumbled.
Victor's lip curled and she snorted.
Some people have imaginary friends. It figures you'd have built a synthetic one. Very well, but remember that I warned you.
Chapter 2. Jezebel. The security collar wasn't what Clemson expected. A tubular mesh, like a superfine chainmail, hung between two amulets, each an oval just larger than the pad of his thumb. Victor and Clemson each pressed a thumb to an amulet until the mesh changed from gray to white. When Victor wrapped the necklace around Clemson's neck, the amulet snapped together into a seamless hole, and the mesh turned a deep forest green. Porous and warm, it lay comfortably against his skin, but tightened when he tried to wedge a finger under it.
Don't try to pull it off, Victor warned. It could break your neck.
Although alarming, this was something he'd have to deal with later.
What does it all do?
He let the necklace alone, and it relaxed, flowing like a liquid until it rested above his collarbone and lay almost flat. The amulet settled into a suprasternal notch. It would be easy to forget it was there.
The necklace will report your location continuously and record audio and panoramic video.
Victor related this as if reading from a brochure.
It's also a key, part of your identity. Once we've entered you into the system, it'll allow you to open doors.
Victor poked at her GLADIG, and an 8-foot cube with rounded edges faded into view in front of them. The near wall split open, revealing a well-lit compartment. Victor stepped in and waited.
I assure you this gondola is safer than riding a horse.
Clemson followed his walking tool chest into the space. He wasn't sure what he was expecting, but richwood paneling wasn't on the list. The featureless white ceiling glowed softly, illuminating wooden walls, brass railing, and a thick green carpet. As the doors swung closed, he rubbed a boot on the carpet, finding it both yielding and grippy. Victor spoke at her brick again.
Relax for a moment while the gondola fits us with droid crutches.
What's a droid crutch?
They keep our skeletons from bumping against the droid side walls, an uncomfortable experience, I assure you. They'll only be necessary until we're lifted out of the influence of this sphere.
He grimaced at the odd sensation, as if someone were massaging his intestines.
And then?
The ship's gravity will keep us centered in each of the ship's volumes. The walls receded, then stabilized, making Clemson grab the railing. The wooden components of his tool chest vanished, leaving the metal tools and hardware floating in the air. The light shifted to violet, then blue, then green, and Victor's robes changed from the reddish wood grain to a solid sapphire blue. Clemson counted to 10 before the doors opened again. A dozen men and women in crisp sapphire blue uniforms lined a short hallway. Tight collars rose to their jawlines, and copper buttons made double-dotted lines up their jackets. Although their physiques varied wildly, most of their skin tones clustered within human norms. None of them had horns or tails. A woman barked something in a language that made Clemson's head hurt, but thankfully wasn't trade speak. Victor spoke a single word, and the assembly saluted and filed out through a doorway at the far end of the entry hall, leaving only the woman.
"Clemson, this is Jotun, my chief of staff," Victor stated, a bored impatience laid over her trill. "Jotun, assign a cabin to Clemson. He'll be with us until we find the hecatomb." "Now, Clemson, I believe you owe me a Gladig." She held out a hand.
Clemson pulled the device from a pocket and handed it to Victor, who smiled and gave a slight bow.
"Thank you. Please join me for dinner this evening."
She glided off, leaving Clemson with Jotun.
"Your room is this way,"
Jotun stated in an oddly staccato Panthroplian. The Hellion walked to the door, then turned to face Clemson.
"Come along, alien. Don't dawdle."
The wooden parts on his tool chest had reappeared, so Clemson grabbed the handle and twisted, extending its wheels. He didn't want to get separated from his luggage. The corridor she led him through awed Clemson with its sublime elegance. The ever-present glowing white ceiling illuminated walls covered in diagonal plaid weave of gold and copper. Intricate wooden frescoes crowned the walls with illustrations of a story outside of Clemson's experience. Brass handrails lined the path at waist height. While they walked, Jotun accessed her Gladig and told him,
"You now have basic guest privileges. Your mobility will be limited to the servants' hall until Victor gives further instructions."
She paused, then added with disdain,
"She's a big fan of yours, so that should be soon."
Hellion crewmen scoffed as they passed in the hallway. Clemson just smiled back with his favorite big goofy grin. Clemson stopped when he spotted a box rolling along the edge of a side hallway. It polished the railing with a mechanical arm. His tool chest pushed him along a few inches before he skidded to a stop. Hellions have monks? He leaned over for a closer look. Its slow, jerky behavior suggested poor motion planning algorithms. He tapped on it, noticing that unable to infuse more workable materials with strength via alchemy, they'd resorted to building it out of metal and some kind of resin. A boot to his chest sent him sprawling. Landing hard on his injured shoulder, he cried out and rolled onto his back. A deep voice yelled, "Don't touch what isn't yours, alien!" A large crewman loomed over him. Jotun stepped in with an open-hand attack to the man's throat, knocking the man off his feet and slamming him to the floor. Clemson blinked at the physics-defying performance. There was no way Jotun could weigh enough to do that.
Jotun didn't quite yell, "Not this one, McKeesiel. This is the Builder. If by some chance you killed him, Victor would slay you and buy out your debt for the rest of eternity."
Clemson pushed himself to his feet while McKeesiel backed off, his eyes darting between Clemson and Jotun. A screech echoed through the hallway, rising in pitch until it coalesced into a pure tone.
"Grab the railing,"
Jotun stated. He grabbed the brass railing just in time to have the floor drop out from underneath him. Reflexively, he squeezed the rail tighter, and his head bumped against the ceiling. No, wait, that was the wall. He'd pivoted around the railing and hung sideways, weightless, while his stomach churned with motion sickness. The others in the hall looked on, smiling in various shades of cruel amusement. They all floated no more than an inch from the ground. After a few seconds, gravity returned, dumping Clemson and his tool chest onto the floor. The Hellions laughed as Clemson picked himself up a second time. Jotun continued on her way as if nothing had happened, leaving Clemson to grab his box and follow. When he caught up to her, he asked, "What was that about?"
"Transition to void space."
"Oh, no, I'm used to that from portal travel. I meant the kick."
"He was just keeping you in your place."
"My place is at the end of his boot?"
The edge of her lip twitched upward.
"From his perspective, yes. Being let into a Hellion transport might make you aliens start thinking you deserve special treatment. Most Hellions would call it level setting."
"I take it you aren't usually into collaboration."
"We don't need you."
"As a race, no. And yet you owe me. How did that happen?"
She ignored the question as they turned into a short hallway that ended in a large archway, its portal blocked by a pair of enameled panels. A light above the portal glowed green.
"This is an elevator," Jotun informed him. "It's the only way you'll be able to traverse between hulls."
A little peeved that Jotun felt she needed to explain elevators, Clemson asked, "If it crosses volumes, doesn't that make it a hypervator?"
"You're the clever one, aren't you?"
Jotun pressed a button next to the archway. "People keep telling me that. I don't buy it. How do you know Panthropolian?"
"We did some business in Panthropolis a couple centuries ago."
"Centuries?
Were Hellions nigh immortal too?" The doors opened and they stepped into a room like a gondola, but cheaper, lit with a pale green light emanating from the ceiling.
"That's a long time to remember a language."
She raised an eyebrow at him, but then raised the other and sighed.
"I took an eidetic memory splice the last time I incarnated."
Jotun pressed a button inside the hypervator and the doors closed. Even in Panthropolian, those words didn't parse well.
"That sounds useful."
"To be honest, I'd rather be able to forget."
Bits of horror from his past flashed through his mind, and he shuddered at the prospect of being nigh immortal and unable to forget anything. The light shifted to yellow, and the wood panels in the doorway slid apart. Warm light and the smell of ozone, sweat, and machine oil spilled in. As they stepped into the corridor, a ball flew past Clemson's face. Jotun plucked it from the air and turned towards the projectile's source.
"No balls in the hallway! Reduced rations!"
Down the hallway, a grubby man in brown overalls whined. Jotun didn't back down.
"No whining, and I'm keeping this."
She tucked the ball under her arm and stalked off, poking at her gladig. Clemson shrugged and followed. Compared to the previous hallway, the austerity of this one felt dingy. Light gray walls stood between white glowing ceilings and knobby gray floors. A chrome railing split the wall, and white rectangles with black text took the place of decorations. Jotun continued to swipe at her gladig as they walked. Clemson wondered what it did to keep her attention. He needed to prioritize figuring out how they worked. Ahead, a panel on a door flickered between white and black, then settled on being black on white, with three prominent characters and some lines of Hellion script. Jotun stepped in front of the doorway.
"This is your quarters. Dinner is scheduled for 3 hours from now. I suggest you wash some of the stink off of yourself before then."
The door opened and she stalked off. Clemson figured out how to lock himself in, then examined the room. It left much to be desired, but nothing to be required. It was spacious for a cabin on a ship. After 300 years of living in pre-industrial conditions, he found the stainless steel flush toilet to be a comforting amenity. He could learn to ignore the odors that clung to the lack of decor. Eyes closed, he sat on the floor and leaned back against his bunk. When he forced his blood pressure to relax, the world spun with his exhaustion. He sat, breathed, relaxed, and stabilized his consciousness, but he couldn't sleep yet. When he felt balanced, he ordered his trunk monkey to help him out of his armor, laying the plates out to diffuse his odor into the space. With his traumatized shoulder, it took him a few tries to pull his jerkin off, but he knew that babysitting the injury wouldn't make it heal any faster. Using water from the metal sink, he scrubbed a chunk of floor and told his tool chest to settle on the spot. Once it was set, he triggered an alchemical reaction. The bottom edge softened, settled, then rehardened with a sucking click. The chest now adhered to the floor such that a thief would bend the floor before he could pull it up. A sink bath scrubbed the worst of his stink off while the trunk monkey set out his ceremonial robes, then took up a guard stance against the door. He had no reason to trust anyone on this ship. The first few hours were the most likely time for a surprise attack, so there was no way he could sleep right now. He settled on the floor with his back against a corner of the room and meditated. From his shoulders outward, he forced his muscles to relax. His injury still throbbed, and a mild hangover made everything worse, but he breathed slowly until he could let go of it all. When he reached a null mental state, he thought back to the moment he'd woke up and reviewed the past day in as much detail as he could recall, letting his subconscious pick over the memories like a gardener. The technique didn't eliminate the need for sleep, but combined with vigor, it would manage sleep deprivation for a few days. The more he thought about it, the more he regretted his decision. Hitching a ride on a Hellion void ship may not have been his brightest idea.
Chapter 3. The Void. The lights in the hypervator turned green. Something projected a faint grid of lines on the walls that matched his sense of motion as the hypervator rose, rotated, then moved forward. The doors slid open and Jotun held out a hand, indicating Clemson should precede her. He stepped out onto a dark plateau under a black sky filled with planets. Not little white dots in the sky or models hanging from a hidden ceiling. The planets were full-sized. Some were close enough that he could see the clouds swirling above the oceans and continents. This was a view of the void, something he'd only glimpsed as blurs like paint smudges while falling between portals. He scanned the spheres for Panthropolis, but there were too many. Walking to the edge, he looked down to see a roiling sea of black and purple thousands of miles below. Small planets honeycombed its surface, half-submerged like bubbles in a boiling pot. Vertigo drove him to step back.
"Isn't it beautiful?"
Victor asked with a melodious lilt. Clemson jumped at her sudden appearance behind him. He looked around, realizing that Jotun hadn't joined him. Victor was the only person on the platform. She continued,
"We call that the Cradle of Worlds.
Those are proto-worlds where mankind hasn't formed social groups larger than about 150 people. Their surfaces shift, and anything that tries to get near them just vanishes. Deadly, but breathtaking."
"Is that really the void?"
He stepped forward again, but some trick of acoustics alerted him to a transparent wall.
"If light flowed through the void," Victor tapped the surface, "and these were windows, this is what you'd see. We call these depth-defining displays, or just 3-vids. They're built by trained bacteria and powered by electricity."
He looked to the sides and noticed that the 3-vids had a maximum viewing angle, beyond which the walls were darker than the space between the planets and entirely non-reflective. Based on the extents of the panel, he estimated that the room was only 50 feet from the hypervader to the far edge. The wall arched over his head like a greenhouse. If the hypervader was centered, the room was only 20 feet wide. Victor glided to a shelf amongst the wooden furniture that divided the room in half.
"Join me for a drink?"
Clemson examined the shelf of exotically shaped bottles, unable to form an opinion about their contents and dubious that any would be a good choice. Victor cocked an eyebrow and half-grinned, then spoke a single word. Clemson cringed as Hellion tradespeak stabbed his mind. The synthetic language had a complexity that overloaded his gift of tongues every time he heard it. Its syntax dug into his awareness like tree roots through pavement, and the extensive vocabulary swamped his sense of meaning. While maintaining the well-structured form of legalese, it still managed to overshadow the inherent slipperiness of arcology floor slang. Her words translated to,
"I demand a witness."
A circular section of the arch ceiling slid down to head height, and a machine above cast a weak spotlight on her. A gargle of syllables spewed from the machine, leaving him perplexed. He'd never seen a speaking machine that wasn't from Panthropolis, and his gift didn't translate for it. Victor spoke again. He couldn't grasp the full implications, but it decomposed to,
"I attest that I will not attempt to poison Clemson, nor will anyone under my command."
The machine blurted a quick response, then slid back into its hole. A little disoriented, Clemson asked, "What was that?"
"A solemn oath not to poison you. Call it a bet. If I'm forced to poison you for some reason, it would cost me more than your life is worth, and your life is worth a lot. Will you join me for a drink now?"
That was a better guarantee than he was expecting. Thank you. If they wanted to poison him, he was pretty sure he'd already be poisoned. "I'll have what you're having. I don't know what hospitality to expect from the Ravagers of Worlds." Victor rolled her eyes.
"That campaign always comes back to haunt us. Rest assured that the perpetrators have been dealt with quite harshly."
She poured a purple liquid into a pair of cordial glasses.
"What does harshly mean compared to keeping a world at bloody war for 2 centuries?
"Oh, that wasn't their crime.
It's not like we could prosecute someone for selling things to people who want them." She put the bottle back on its shelf and carried the glasses to where he stood.
"Hell relies too much on imports to forbid influencing other cultures. The real damage was to our trade opportunities."
She made a show of pouring the purple liquid back and forth between the two glasses, then offered both to him.
"In effect, they were punished for getting us all sanctioned. They were damned with a colossal lien, and most were disincorporated."
"Does that mean executed?"
He picked one at random.
"Execution is a prerequisite, yes. Speaking of which, that Gladig has shown us the trail of our thieves. We should overtake them within the hour. Voxy?"
she called to the ceiling.
"Shift to abstract mode and display the impulse wake of the hecatomb."
The planets shrank and drew closer, transforming into spheres with geometric patterns and pastel colors representing continents and oceans. The impenetrable blackness of the background became an impenetrable light gray. The nearest planet now looked to be a few dozen feet away. A speckled purple path extended towards the nearest planets, near which a red ball pulsed. The contents of his cordial glass trickled down his throat with the smooth burn of a berry liqueur.
His wonder shifted between the technology of the display and the view of the planets they provided. He noted with fascination that the room's furniture was reflected in his cordial glass, but the planets weren't. He held the glass between him and one of the planets, and refractions appeared when it came close to line of sight.
Victor pointed to the dot. "That's my stolen cargo ship. Voxy display courses."
Lines swept through each sphere in the display, and illegible lettering floated near them.
"It says they're about 1,000 kilometers away, an hour at our current speed."
"What's a kilometer?"
It had always puzzled Clemson that the worlds used similar inches and miles, but he'd come to accept it.
"It's about 0.6 mile.
Her eyebrows knit.
"They aren't moving. They should at least try to run and hide."
A tone sounded, and a half-height panel in the rear wall near the hypervator slid open. A small table rolled in, unattended, brass-domed plates sitting on its white cloth surface.
"Dinner has arrived," she announced. "Have a seat."
The trolley rolled to the room's far end, where a meeting table sat under a half-domed ceiling. Angular limbs extended from the trolley and passed a set of dishes onto the table. They set two place settings. Plate, glasses, silverware, laying the pieces out with a rhythmic beat like a dinner bell made of plywood.
"Oh, right," he commented. "You have monks. I'd love to get a better look at them."
"We call them daemons. They fill the same purpose, but use different principles."
Clemson counted plates.
"Just us?"
He cocked an eyebrow at her.
"The officers aren't ready for you, I'm afraid. I wouldn't want them wasting our time with petty challenges when I have so many questions."
She took a seat on the far side of the table. Clemson looked at the other seat, noting how the daemon avoided him.
"If you're intending to seduce me," he commented, "I should warn you that I'm particularly thick about such things."
She trilled a tinkling laugh and smiled broadly.
"Clemson, you say the sweetest things. Rest assured, should I have that inclination, I'll be very straightforward. At the moment, I'd rather know how you took down the Visconti Conflagrante. I don't believe that you summoned a dragon. It's not your style."
"Summoned a dragon? That would have made things so much easier. I just sold him a flamethrower, knowing he would ignore the instructions."
The main course consisted of a plate of baked tubers drenched in a flavorful orange sauce with a pepper base, arranged on a bed of greens. Delicious, but unsatisfying to Clemson's palate. Frustrated with trying to eat one-handed, he gave up on his fork and pulled a pair of pliers from his belt. They conversed about the vassal politics that surrounded his travels and obscure bits of Panthropolian history. A whoop-whoop noise interrupted them, and the walls strobed red. Clemson licked his pliers clean and put them away.
"That's not a good thing, is it?"
Victor turned to look at the icon representing the hecatomb.
"I think it's an attack warning. The Jezebel's never been attacked before."
She consulted the Threevid, where a red speck moved towards them from the pulsing red dot.
"We should still be out of range of their defensive weaponry."
She stood with an exasperated sigh.
"I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut our dinner short. Voxy," she announced, "open the walls."
The walls went black, then split vertically in several places, breaking the illusion of space. Their platform hung over a luminous white room like a gantry. The inner walls bloomed upward to meet the ceiling of the larger room below. The outer room's walls were also Threevid displays, and the inner walls merged with them seamlessly. A view graced the front wall similar to the one they'd been watching, but drawn back to include the Jezebel. 5 building-like shapes rotated on the screen to the left, color-coded so that Clemson could tell that it was the 5 hyperhulls of a single ship. On the right, 3 more shapes turned, 2 of them tubular and 1 like a giant brick with 4 skinny grain silos attached.
"Captain, report."
Victor stepped off the edge of the platform. Clemson walked to the edge and saw that she had landed on a disc that eased her down to the floor about 10 feet below. Blue-clad Hellions sat at consoles that curved around the walls, and a trio stood at consoles in the middle, facing forward.
"Mr. McKeesiel, what do we know?"
The question came from a well-decorated man sitting in a rigid, oversized chair below Clemson. A tall man stood while his fingers danced across a surface that resembled a drafting table. Purple welts peeked up over the man's collar. Arrows suggesting motion and acceleration appeared on the walls, and transparent cones implied probable eventual locations.
"It's a shuttlecraft, Captain. Intercept in 15 minutes.
Victor glanced at the display on the right, then announced,
"Shoot it down."
"The people on board may have useful information," the captain countered.
"I don't want information. I want my ship back. Shoot it down."
"They haven't responded to our hail yet," he protested.
"I demand a witness,"
she declared with exasperation, tradespeak stabbing Clemson in the brain.
"I accuse this man of insubordination while under fire."
The man frowned and stood with his arms crossed, anger clear on his face. The familiar sexless voice made an incomprehensible response.
In the seconds that followed, Clemson felt like he was the only one breathing. A voice made another pronouncement. A high-pitched whine came from somewhere below. The captain's eyes went wide. He took a single step before a whirring projectile flew into the back of his head and exploded with a pop. The Hellion dropped to the floor, a small section of the back of his skull now splattered across the floor. Clemson sucked in a breath, but Victor just covered her eyes with a hand as if hiding from embarrassment. Everyone else stared at their panels, pretending that nothing had happened. Victor stepped over the corpse and took the chair.
Abaddon, do we have a firing solution?
The woman looked up from her console and replied,
Yes, Victor.
Then shoot it.
Starburst or Hellfire?
One of each.
Firing.
A point of yellow light appeared on the display, followed by a white one.
Interception in 8 minutes.
Somewhere below Clemson, a door opened. Two men in vibrant red jumpsuits guided a gurney and a big metal cylinder to the body. Those on the bridge ignored the men as they loaded the former captain onto the gurney, then connected the gurney to the side of the cylinder. A panel in the side of the cylinder slid open and two spindly mechanical arms reached out. They grabbed the cadaver around the neck and pulled its head into the space behind the panel. A mechanical whirring preceded a wet crunch, and a green light on top of the cylinder turned on. The color of the men's jumpsuits hid the blood that spurted onto them. One attendant wheeled the machine out like a wheelbarrow. Clemson took deep breaths, attempting to relax the strangling tightness in his chest while the other attendant wiped up the blood as if someone had spilled their drink. Clemson wasn't sure what disturbed him more, the man's death or the impression that this was a common occurrence. Victor popped up next to Clemson, launched by the disc that had caught her on the way down. Hellions must not suffer from bad knees. He asked,
Victor, if I may be so bold, why did you kill your captain?
Sadness washed over her features.
I'm sorry you had to see that. I didn't kill him. That was a suicide.
She held up a finger to stave off his objection.
Voxy, bring up the balance sheet for Dragar Truffle. Convert the ledger to Panthroplian.
A wall to the right folded back down, and a mammoth ledger appeared behind the wall. The numbers added up to a negative number around 100. Victor tapped the back of her hand, and hands identical to hers appeared within the wall. A finger touched the word violations, and a scroll came up from behind the ledger, unrolling to reveal a long list. The bottom entry was labeled insubordination, with a value of 4.173, followed by a 7.3x multiplier labeled under fire.
Around age 150, Hellions sometimes feel that they've plateaued, Victor explained. Despondency can set their social contributions in the negative. This isn't the first time he's endangered the crew. If they don't get over themselves before their balance hits a life century, they become damned.
What does that mean?
I'll spare you the trade speak headache. They're killed, then their connectome is scanned and stored in the database of the damned. If someone pays off their damnation, their connectome will be inserted into a youthful clone. The memories provide continuity of identity, if not personality. The new incarnations are indentured until they pay off their debt. He's been a loyal employee, so I'll probably pick up the next Dragar Truffle. Clemson read up the list of violations. Even the dates had been translated to a Panthroplian equivalent, and Dragar Truffle had been racking up bad behavior for 5 years. The way he stomped on Victor's toes, he wasn't just asking for it, he was insisting on it. While he read down the list, Abaddon called up,
The target isn't dodging or deploying countermeasures. Impact in 5 seconds.
The yellow dot merged with the one representing the shuttle, and a red sphere expanded from it.
Confirmed destroyed.
The white dot vanished moments later.
Victor, we have a problem. This came from Mr. McKeesiel. The shuttle was destroyed, but it released a phage.
A phage? Down here?
The concern in Victor's voice didn't reach her face.
Is it a threat?
The shuttle vanished on the big display on the right, to be replaced by a black amorphous mass surrounded by writhing tentacles.
It would be if it had been released much closer, McKeesiel responded. We'll have to go around, and it's blocking our view of the hecatomb.
Adjusting course to avoid. Clemson wasn't sure who announced that, but the lines describing the Jezebel's course shifted, avoiding a purple bubble that appeared around the phage. Victor turned back to Clemson.
Do you know about phages?
Clemson shook his head.
They show up in flocks after a planet's been depopulated and disintegrated.
Mr. McKeesiel announced.
I spotted them. They've gone under the planet and are headed slowward. The projected course leads to hell.
Lovely. Set an intercept course. Catch them before we get into Hellion void space. Voxy, close the walls.
As the walls folded down around them, he followed her back to the sideboard. She poured herself another drink.
We aren't going to catch them.
They thought the Jezebel was faster.
It is, but travel across time domains has an acclimation cost. If we rise too quickly, we'll die of hypothermia. While under the planet, they benefit from the planet's time stability.
Her drawl somehow made even technical terms sound like a social event.
They're getting a head start.
By under, you mean wither, right?
Yes. For some forsaken reason, while the rest of society calls it up, people on void ships call it down. Very confusing.
What happens when we reach Hellion void space?
That's the Void Patrol's domain. They enforce a strict no-shooting policy. Even I would be tagged as an aggressor and vaporized.
Could we appeal to them for help?
If our objective were to have the entire cargo impounded as contraband, then that would be a good way to go. Its cargo would be filtered through the gristmills of corruption, and I have far more valuable property on that ship than you do. I'd be better off letting them pass and hunting them down on the surface. She tapped her nose with a finger theatrically, then pointed at Clemson. May I offer you a business proposition?
Does it involve going to hell?
Yes, but that isn't as bad as it sounds. If you ever want to see your mule again, you're going to have to help us look. I know you can see thaumaturgy in use, and that may be crucial. The obstacle is that you'd have to sign yourself into a period of indentured servitude.
Clemson mulled over that.
How long a period? Is this one of those scams where the company store owns your soul?
No. Captive consumers make for a poor economy. I guarantee that lack of funding won't be what keeps you on the planet. Voxy, please display a view from my penthouse.
The tactical display faded to be replaced by a breathtaking cityscape. Elegant spires of glass and steel rose over a carpet of skyscrapers. Multicolored ground vehicles crawled along gray ribbons bordered by strips of vegetation. A sprinkling of flying craft flew around transparent walkways that reached between towers.
This is Malabos, capital city of hell, and home to 30 million people. Voxy, do the tour.
The image shifted to a field of well-manicured grass speckled with trees. Spires peeked over the trees that surrounded the field. Couples in groups sat on blankets or benches, threw balls around, or jogged on a track.
Hell is the word for earth in our language. Why so many people use it as a pejorative is a matter of deep philosophy, but it all comes from people who have never spent time there.
The blatant sales job annoyed Clemson, but he let it slide, giving Victor room to make mistakes. The scene changed to a view of a sporting event in a colossal stadium. Men and women wearing two colors chased a ball around. Tens of thousands in the stands, representing a wide range of skin tones and body types, stood and cheered as the ball was kicked across the field.
Our world is made of people like any other. Continuous immigration has allowed us to absorb a rich culture.
The view shifted again, now revealing a semicircular room full of desks that faced a podium. A crimson-faced man spoke to a prim audience.
Our democratically elected representatives preside over the operation of government, providing the economy with a stable foundation.
The image now split, displaying massive metal ships being unloaded on the left and a colorful multi-level shopping structure on the right.
A heavy question, Clemson interrupted. Where are the children?
Victor stopped, confusion and concern clouding her flawless complexion.
Children?
She asked, as if she didn't understand the word, but then added,
You don't know.
She was playing games and Clemson didn't appreciate it.
Know what?
Her expression shifted to one of sympathy.
Hell has no children. We've been sterile for 2,000 years. Anybody who's ever gone over the cusp or traveled the void is sterile.
She paused, sadness filling her eyes. Clemson couldn't tell if she was putting on a show.
As are the children of the gifts.
She walked over to a bookcase near the sideboard.
No, I know you're lying. I've had children since I left Panthropolis.
You might want to sit down.
She handed him a book with Panthropolian print on the cover. The Chronicles of Clemson Murawo Shoaza, The Builder, Book 2. He scanned the opening sentences while Victor continued.
The paternity tests are in Appendix 6. Julius turned out to be the son of Marius Dorogenus, a foot soldier in your 3rd regiment. Valesco was easier to determine, being the spawn of General Gragianus, who killed Dorogenus about a year before Valesco's birth.
Clemson accepted this as unprovable, but not improbable. His wife had always required more attention than he had available. Can I keep this? He asked, having been relieved of his remorse for killing Gragianus on the way out.
My gift. You deserve to know. It's always enlightening to see what others are writing about you. I'll have copies of the other 2 volumes sent to your room.
He closed the book and set it on the table, taking a seat. While they were focused on the attack, the mechanical servants had removed the dishes.
Victor took the seat across from him and stayed quiet as the waltz shifted from a concert venue featuring a string quartet to an amusement park with dangerous-looking rides. He had no idea what to expect from Hal, but this little drama gave him a clue about what they wanted him to believe, and he took an intuitive leap.
"Let's draw up a contract. I'll give you up to a year, hell time, during which you will be responsible for keeping me alive. After which, you are required to extract me from hell and drop me into a fast time-set planet. Does that work?"
"I can't guarantee your safety if you get heavy-handed, but otherwise it's amenable. Voxy, bring up the contract module's playset. We need to build a relationship."
Chapter 4. Arrival. Watching the Jezebel's approach to hell from the command deck almost made the long negotiation sessions worthwhile. 5 worlds dominated the void in front of them. Even if Hell weren't the one in the center, he would have guessed it from the weird brown cast. Victor named the other 4 Tartarus, Sheol, Silencia, and Gehenna. Dots of every color flew in channels that stretched between the 5 worlds, drawing a lopsided pentagram in the sky. Clemson pointed to a glowing orange dot that occupied a place where another planet might sit. "What's that?" She didn't look away from the view.
"It's what's left of Pandemonium. The Ravager of Worlds thing you mentioned? After Mouse and the Librarian chased us off, they enjoyed a great peace for nearly 500 years before someone got bored and they bombed themselves into extinction. Now it's a feast for a few billion phages."
He'd always wondered what happened to worlds that go over the cusp. Instant vanishing? Chewed up by giant kittens? Filed away for later reference? Now he knew. He felt like Victor had shared the secrets of the universe in an offhand comment. When Hell filled the screen, Victor pointed to the center of the orange smear that bloomed across the continent below them.
"See that patch? That's Malebolge, the heart of civilization."
It did look like a biologically accurate heart. 2 rivers poured into it from the north, but he couldn't spot where they exited in the south. After a brief bout of zero-G during transition, the planet rushed at them, only slowing when it seemed they would crash into it. He had no sense of deceleration. Victor had described airspace restrictions and security measures, but all Clemson gleaned was that they were required to land 200 miles away from the city. The 3 vids went blank as they slid to a stop within a huge gray, blocky terminal building. Victor had coached him on the legal charade that followed his first steps on Hellion soil. A 12 Praetorian soldiers descended upon him the moment he stepped off the gondola, yelling a cacophony of orders and waving weapons in his face. Their armor covered enough of their bodies that Clemson couldn't tell if there were bodies inside the armor. The opaque glass covering their faces gave clues to neither identity nor humanity. He dropped to his knees and put his hands behind his head, letting the Praetorians shackle them behind his back. To Victor's credit, they marched him before a waiting magistrate instead of a waiting cell. The magistrate charged him with illegal immigration. All immigration to hell was illegal. This was just the standard intake process. He pleaded guilty, Victor vouched for his character, and they sentenced him to a year's public service as a member of the Xenoarchaeology Task Force, whatever that meant. The worst part was that the entire proceedings were performed in Hellion tradespeak. Once that was out of the way, a squad of Praetorians escorted him to a vehicle that resembled a giant woodlouse on 10 wheels. A pair of doors opened in the middle of one side, and they uncuffed him and allowed him to climb the stairs within. The ceiling cast diffuse light onto a slim woman in a white jumpsuit sitting on a black, overstuffed chair. A shock of blue hair swept over her otherwise close-cropped blonde, and he noted the green necklace nestled above her collarbone. Opposite her, a full-color display covered the wall, showing the world outside. She stood almost as tall as himself and offered her hand.
"Melbabe plebena,"
she began, initiating the traditional exchange of languages that followed every first meeting between children. Relief washed over Clemson, and he took her hand. There are those that say that children share a single soul. Clemson felt no need to wax poetic, but he had yet to meet one who didn't feel like a long-lost friend. Having one greet him after 2 weeks on a Hellion ship was like sucking in a breath of fresh air after a deep dive in a cesspool. Her deep voice and smoky intonation made her plosive language sound like popping whisper bubbles.
"I'm Serpentine," she said. "I'd welcome you to hell, but you might not get the joke."
She drew patterns in the air, and mechanical arms whirred along tracks on the ceiling, depositing a black block across from Serpentine's chair.
"Have a seat."
The block hissed and unfolded, then expanded into a chair that matched hers.
We have about an hour.
Clemson sat carefully, surprised by how firm the chair could be for something mostly made of air.
I'm the builder. Thank you for your hospitality. Do you know where I can find my Thor mechanical mule?
He felt the vehicle ease into motion, and dim vertical lines processed across the wall from the front of the bus to the back.
Someone stole your mule?
She slid back into her chair and lit a glass pipe.
Well, that explains how they got you here.
She took a drag, then offered the pipe to Clemson, but he shook his head.
How did she know about the mule?
Oh, right, the Chronicles.
What do the Chronicles say about the mule?
She blew smoke out her nose and laughed an ill-mannered snicker.
You won't like it.
He raised an eyebrow at her. She shrugged.
They say that even the best taxidermy couldn't disguise the thing's awkward shape, but that it moved enough like a horse to make you look twice.
His eyebrows scrunched.
Ugly but functional. Is that supposed to be a bad thing?
He was politely saying that your efforts to make it walk like an equine were like putting a coat of paint on a porcupine.
Humph, Clemson grinned. Perhaps I should be complimented that he insulted me so eloquently.
She wagged her head.
Good point. Before we say much more, you need to know that Hellions are watching and recording everything we say and do.
She tilted her head up and called out in Hellion Common.
Bus, replay the last 5 seconds of audio.
From nowhere in particular, Serpentine's voice stated,
You need to know that Hellions are watching and recording everything we say and do.
Clemson felt a weird dissociation as his gift translated her words while she wasn't saying them. Clemson had seen worlds with magics that enabled remote observation, but the instantaneous replay creeped him out.
Is that a function of our necklaces?
No, viewing the feeds from our necklaces would require paperwork and money. That was just the bus's record. Ubiquitous surveillance is the conjunction between convenience and capitalism. It allows me to command the bus with a word or a gesture, but it's also stored where standard licensing agreements allow wealthy entities to peruse them at their leisure.
Clemson held up his hand.
That sounded important. Can you dumb it down for me?
Just assume that anybody wealthy can be watching us at any time. They know more about the gifts than we do, but don't discuss our bequests if you can help it.
She took another hit.
Getting us killed is a de facto sport, which brings me to the next topic.
She pointed her pipe at him.
You need to learn the languages.
Clemson grimaced. He knew 15 machine languages, but had never managed fluency in a second human one. His gift served him for everything except writing, and languages bounced off his brain like ephemeral gossip. She fixed him with a glare and spoke in trade speak.
Don't dismiss this. The High Hellion language of trade is a deadly hazard.
A spike of pain shot through Clemson's head. Mercifully, she continued in her own language.
Anybody who knows it can use it to stun, disorient, distract, and misdirect. So the less you rely on the gift, the better. Don't bother trying to learn how to read it, though. It uses 30-stroke pictograms that morph based on inflection. Just use your Gladig's translator.
Clemson sighed and rubbed his bald head, although the headaches never lingered.
Point made. What about High Hellion and Common?
Common is the language you'll need to talk to their machines. Fortunately, the machines at the headquarters can teach it to you as you use them. High Hellion can wait. It's only useful when casually conversing with the indigenous Hellions, and that's what Tongues does best.
She leaned back and stared into the distance, her strip of blue hair shifting to green. Clemson waited for something else to happen, but then asked,
Is getting a ride off world difficult?
She startled and her hair reverted to blue.
Oh, right. I was doing something. This stuff only lasts 15 minutes, but it helps to filter out the inconsequentials.
What is it?
Hexweed.
Serpentine didn't quite drawl, but she took her time with the words.
Hemp cultivated by plant masters down the gradient. Relaxing. Want some?
Maybe later. How do I leave?
She sucked a breath in through her perfect teeth.
Bribe a freighter, pay off a diplomat, have a fan sneak you on board. Plenty of Hellions are glad to be rid of us, and the fans can always be useful.
He was starting to see a pattern.
What do they have against us?
She took another drag and swirled a finger around in the cloud of smoke.
We threaten the one thing that really matters to most Hellions. Superiority. It bugs them that we aren't trapped into playing their games. It's like we think we're special or something.
Still, most Hellions are perfectly happy to let us wander around as curiosities. Just don't mistake it for affection.
That's depressing.
Nah, just instinctive. Hatred is what you get when someone proves you wrong, and you really don't want to be wrong.
We're an inconvenient truth, and there's the urge to kill the messenger. That's a 1-2 punch from cognitive dissonance.
Would you stay? Me personally, or any of us?
Either, both?
She poked the controls of her chair, and it crawled towards him like a slug.
We all have our reasons. Soulcatcher thinks he's influencing the establishment for the better. Maybe he is. Blackmore is playing some long game.
Her chair pulled alongside his, armrest to armrest, facing the opposite direction.
The Oracle left once and escaped once, but came back on her own this time. I think she scares them. Cook won't leave without Soulcatcher, and I think Teddy Bear is just here to keep me sane.
And you?
She took his hand.
I'm here for you.
Her tender eyes locked with his for a sweet, soulful moment.
And then she broke out into snorting laughter.
I got you. Buss, display his expression.
Yep, she got him good. Clemson laughed in spite of himself at the 4-foot-tall visage of abject horror that appeared on the walls.
Is that hexweed legal? I think I'd like to try it now.
She handed him a freshly packed pipe and something to light it with.
Legality doesn't translate well to hell. The only punishment for anything is a fine. For drugs, that translate to a tax you pay when you purchase it, or triple that if you don't pay it up front. The tax on hexweed is just enough to fund the enforcement of the prohibition against hexweed. I'll cover you. Honestly, I'm here to give children the best chance of leaving here alive. Statistically, if you're still here in a year, you'll probably never leave.
Clemson coughed up a cloud and Serpentine handed him a glass of water. He recalled that a year was the limit on his agreement with Victor.
Would they chase me down?
Nope. You wouldn't run. You'll feel the draw soon enough. It's like, of all the worlds, this is where the curse of wanderlust wants us to go.
I fight that a lot in fast time. It always feels like I'm letting someone down when I travel to a faster world.
It's a lot less subtle up here.
Her finger drew a slow circle above her head.
This is the ocean that the rivers of guilt pour into. Oh, that's a good segue. Do you want to hear the punchline for this complete joke of a world?
I'm sure it will save time.
Whenever another world goes over the cusp and vanishes, about a quarter of their population shows up here. All of them fresh from an apocalypse and looking for a fight.
You're serious.
This time.
She nestled deeper into her chair.
How do they get here?
He caught himself over-enunciating, got self-conscious, then lost himself in thought for a moment before she replied.
No telling. They call it getting raptured.
The raptured say it's like stepping through a dream. They always appear when nobody is looking, and they're always carrying weapons. The statement raised images in his mind. That must be the hexweed hitting him. He clung to his focus and asked, "What happens to the other 3/4?
No telling. Maybe there are 3 more hells out there somewhere. The Hellions have only mapped about 1/5 of the void.
They know how big the universe is.
Even after seeing the view from Jezebel's bridge, he'd still thought it might be endless.
They say about 8,000 worlds. Something about the curvature of subvoid blah blah blah. Ask Rickman. He'll insult you for not knowing, but he'll make sure you know what you're missing out on.
Clemson tucked that tidbit away.
How many people are on hell?
She waggled a hand. 8 to 12 billion?
That's a suspiciously wide range.
Like I said, they all show up looking for a fight, and hell doesn't disappoint them. Buss, clear the windows.
The wall above waist height turned transparent, revealing an endless desert. Worse than a desert, fine orange powder blew across a sun-cracked plain with only rocks and sparse shrubbery in its way. Slatted fences kept the dust from drifting across the smooth gray pavement that their bus shared with endless lines of windowless segmented behemoths.
The orange blemish is the demilitarized zone around Malebolge. It's a big area, but 500 people show up here every day, and most of them can see the gray line over there.
She jabbed her thumb towards the front of the bus. They were rolling down a slight incline, so he could see a gray line separating orange land from blue sky. He scanned the dust in horror and took another hit from the pipe.
I'm going to need a better definition of xenoarchaeology.
Nah. Everybody benefits from the fuzziness, especially us. We used to be called the Demonology Department before the kinder, gentler wording took hold. It's an excuse to keep us busy. Our real occupation is being planetary-wide celebrities. It gets us into a lot of useful places. Celebrities, because of the Chronicles. Originally, yeah.
80 years ago, somebody wrote a more interesting version. Before long, people were making low-res animations and videos. Victor's businesses make money off of video stories, collector's cards, action figures, all sorts of things.
What's an action figure?
Statuette caricatures, usually posable, not usually flattering.
Do I get some of that money?
Most of it, actually. Victor holds your shares in escrow, but that doesn't stop us from spending it. Added to your salary at the XT, this makes you comfortably well off. It's Victor's way of saying, I want to own you forever, which is as close to Hellions get to love. Now that you're here in person, your value will soar. Clemson's mind wandered, considering the possibilities. He drew another breath from the pipe and they sat in silence. The world softened as urgency and chronic anxiety drained away. His consciousness relaxed until he noticed the world beyond the two chairs. The sun behind them cast long shadows across the scorched plain. The rest of the universe receded, dissolving both place and time, leaving just here and now. As they approached the gray line, it resolved into a huge wall that enclosed a forest. A flock of birds circled like buzzards above the intersection of wall and highway. He imagined red-skinned monsters looming over the wall, throwing down thunderbolts, turning an army of bedraggled refugees into orange dust. The hexweed again. Pleasant, but a sense of urgency was getting peevish over being ignored. He set aside the pipe and took a deep breath, buttressing himself against the disorientation. Once through the gate, the flock of birds resolved into small flying daemons, more insectile than avian. They formed a steady stream in the sky above the highway. At their vanishing point, a glimmer crept into the sky.
What's that? He asked.
That's the highest tower in Malibu's, owned by the wealthiest man in the world. The view from the top defines the green zone. A tone chimed from nowhere. Answer it, she announced.
Clemson tried to figure out what he should answer, but a smooth, gentle male voice filled the cabin with a guttural tongue.
That's Soulcatcher. She shifted to Hellion Common. When you listen to him, pretend that you're listening to me. That'll let you borrow the language from me.
She addressed the ceiling.
Go ahead, Soulcatcher. He should be listening now.
Hello, Bilda. This is Soulcatcher. Sorry I couldn't be there in person, but I'm sure you'll understand.
His soothing tones made Clemson believe that he would.
It looks like you're going to get to see the sights earlier than expected. Good news, Serpentine. We have an address on the Daffodil Factory. Teddy Bear's friends in the Immigration Bureau are putting together a raid. Can you meet us there in an hour?
A map appeared on the wall displaying a little blue blinking dot. Serpentine flashed a half-smile at Clemson.
You want to see what we do for fun?
Clemson sighed, resigned to the inevitable.
I could use a distraction. Are my trunk and armor somewhere on board?
Chapter 5, Daffodils. Many wonders competed for Clemson's attention in Malibolge. An organic-looking clump of tall brown hills looked like a trash heap until he noticed people crawling all over their surfaces and traversing gray strands between them. A cube resolved into a rectilinear array of skinny towers, each no more than 30 feet square, connected by a grid of scaffolds. Boring gray buildings sprouted from a graceful geodesic bubble hundreds of feet around. One thing that he didn't wonder about was the providence of the dozen contorted spires that towered over the city. In his experience, the real limit to the height of a world's structures was the creativity of the excuses that people came up with to justify them. The visionaries behind these buildings were very creative. Spires reached through fluffy clouds as much as half a mile into the sky, dwarfing the field of skyscrapers that spread out beneath them. The tallest resembled a bundle of marble columns, each fighting to reach higher than the others. These were not the stout arcologies of Panthropolis, but structures built solely for the purpose of dominating the skyline. An off-ramp dropped the bus into a gray four-laned road. Beetle-like vehicles clumped together with the speeding bus into vehicular pulses. Ahead, a wall of vehicles zipped across an intersection. He braced himself for collision, but the intersection cleared just as they reached it. Serpentine laughed, then put a hand on his arm.
Relax. The vehicles coordinate with flashes of invisible light so they don't crash. It's safer than walking. Far safer than walking on the street.
The bus wound through the side streets before parking itself in a quieter part of town. The black cinder block buildings rose two or three stories above street level. When Clemson walked down the bus's stairs, Jotun greeted him. She maintained her stiff posture while reciting,
Clemson Murawo Shoza.
It has been the decree of the courts that you be remanded into a year's service of the Xenoarchaeology Task Force. I have been assigned as your parole officer for the duration of your stay and will accompany you any time you leave the XT compound.
Parole officer? That sounds like a step down from Chief of Staff.
She drew her lips into a tight frown. The Jezebel is being refitted. There's a Hellion proverb that says, "Be careful of what you do well, lest you do it often." It appears I'm doomed to lead you around a bit longer. She faded into the background.
I believe you have business to attend to. I'll stay out of your way.
A mismatched trio stood to one side. A petite, shapely redhead wore an outfit that revealed a suspicious amount of skin. Her tank top just managed to retain her breasts, and her asymmetrical skirt probably required conscientious posture. Boisterous eyeshadow emphasized her lack of epicanthic folds, suggesting that the feature was a novelty here. The outfit conveyed an impression of street courtesan in a way that transcended cultural boundaries. A thin man stood possessively close to her, wearing a vibrant purple suit, oversized gold spectacles, and a winning smile. His ostentatious jewelry spoke of success a little too loudly to be believed, but there was no mistaking his confident posture. Behind them, a bald man with dark skin loomed in the evening shadows. His expression was unreadable, but his dark gray, tight-fitting tactical armor spoke volumes. The man in purple stepped forward with a friendly swagger. He offered Clemson his hand and spoke with a voice he recognized in a language he'd never heard. When the headache passed, the words translated into, "I am Soul Catcher. I'm glad you can join us tonight. You're about to get a crash course in Hellion politics." Clemson couldn't help but like him.
"Pleased to meet you," he responded. "I understand that my dossier precedes me."
"Indeed it does." Soul Catcher stepped aside, allowing the woman to wrap her arms around him. He usually tensed up for unsolicited hugs, but hers was genuine and friendly enough to make him melt.
"You must be Teddy Bear," he mumbled over her shoulder. "Does your bequest involve really great hugs?"
She stepped back and put a finger to her mischievous smile.
"I suppose you could say that."
She spoke in a language that brought to mind swishing of sharp swords.
"Did you bring your armor? I want to watch you put it on."
"I understand it's somewhere on the bus."
He turned to see a pair of demonic arms unloading it.
"Well, that's convenient."
The bus also disgorged his toolbox. Serpentine slouched against the bus.
"I want to see you put it on, too. I hear it's a great show. Besides, it'll come in handy in a few minutes."
"Okay, this outfit makes me itchy anyway. But first..."
Clemson turned to the tall, dark-skinned man.
"I can't tell if you're Cook or Blackmore. You're too well armed for an oracle."
Also, Serpentine had said that Oracle was a female. He held his hand out to the man. The man stepped forward and took Clemson's hand.
Cook glanced to one side. "I'd also like to see you put your armor on."
That was a little weird. Clemson inhaled to respond, but then noticed a small four-rotor daemon in the direction Cook had glanced. Right, they were being watched. He looked to Soul Catcher, who shrugged.
"Okay, putting on the armor."
He examined his tool chest, noting new primarchs on the seams, but nothing was broken. He whistled the time-keyed unlocking code and ordered the trunk monkey to ready itself. The lid of the chest rose, sprouting six limbs and perched on the chest's rim. By his command, the monk laid out his armor while he checked for sabotage. Satisfied, he pulled the robe over his head, then stood in his underclothes in the middle of the arrayed armor, arms and legs spread. He whistled the command. 160 years of donning his armor while on the go had given him plenty of time to think about how to speed up the process. The monk slid between his legs and grabbed the breastplate and backplate with its forward and rearward arms while raising itself from the ground with the middle arms. The plates clacked together around his chest, and the dexterous monk fingers buckled them together. The machine mounted itself on the armor like a backpack, then passed a stream of wooden plates from the ground to pairs of hands left and right that coupled them together into segmented mail along his arms like spiders spinning a sweater. His arms encased, the monk dropped to the ground to assemble his pelvic and leg armor. He felt particularly proud of the crescendo of clicks as the machine assembled incrementally smaller plates around his legs. Even Jotun applauded when it finished. Teddy Bear walked up and put her palm on his chest.
"I want one."
Soulcatcher put a hand on her shoulder.
"Some of the time. We have maybe 30 minutes before immigration shows up."
She traipsed off to the corner.
"Right, let's get this show on the stage. Serpentine, you want to give us a freight train?"
"Sure," she responded, then turned to Cook. "But I want the builder as my locomotive."
"Fine," Cook responded. "I'll go get a view."
He casually walked across the street and vanished into an alley. Clemson cocked an eyebrow at Serpentine, and she explained,
"All you'll have to do is jog while I'm touching your back."
That didn't sound hard.
"Do you want to build a back ride?"
Serpentine perked up.
"Yes, perfect."
While they waited for the others to get into position, Clemson surveyed the surroundings with an eye trained by decades of civil engineering. The black cinder block walls were hard enough to scratch his armor, so he made a note not to lean on them. The drab gray streets had a gentle crust that would provide decent drainage. Large bluish lights glowed atop poles, supplementing the fading daylight. Daemons whirred and whined in gutters and sidewalks, patrolling for refuse. A soft roar floated around them from all directions as if the city itself were breathing. He found the gentle whoosh of rolling tires more soothing than the clattering rattle of skidders.
He peeked over Serpentine's shoulder. Full-motion video covered the face of her Gladig, displaying a big metal doorway set in a black wall. Clemson wondered what magic provided this.
While Cook took its place, Serpentine briefed him.
"Here, put this in your ear."
He took a small box she offered him and opened it.
"A fish?"
"That's just how they're packaged." He lifted the fish-shaped object from the molded plastic and found it to be gooey like a slug, but not slimy.
"What is this?"
"It's an ear jack. It lets us talk to each other over a distance. Trust me, you need this."
This sounded gross, but he had to trust her. Taking off his helmet, he held the thing next to his ear. He involuntarily spasmed when it slithered in, wet and uncomfortable.
"Gah, why did I do that?"
Serpentine reached out and yanked his earlobe 3 times. His hearing returned, and the sense that his ear was full of water cleared up. She gripped her own earlobe and asked,
"Can you hear me?"
"Yes," he replied.
She was louder in his jacked ear.
"That's weird."
"Squeeze your ear here," she demonstrated, "if you want us to hear you."
"That's going to be hard to do through the helmet."
"We'll figure something out. For today, you can go without your helmet, or you can just listen. Just remember that everyone can hear you when you talk through it."
Everyone. They were serious about this surveillance thing. She pointed her thumb in the direction Teddy Bear and Soulcatcher had gone.
"This is a clandestine pharmaceutical factory," she explained. "In about 20 minutes, the Immigration Management Bureau will raid the factory, not for its illegal pharmaceuticals, but for its illegal aliens. They get bounty credit for each alien they catch."
"I'm guessing there's a reason we're going in before they get here."
"Yep, the factory has mages on their payroll. We're supposed to neutralize hostile alien mages. That's what our task force was chartered for, anyway. We won't catch as many aliens as they would, but they'll lose fewer officers."
"What do we get?"
"Did you miss the part where they won't catch as many of them?"
She paused and Clemson nodded.
"Our cut will pay our expenses."
"Gotcha."
That balanced things better, but there was still something missing.
"This is what you do for fun?"
"Think of it as a contact sport. You'll see."
"What do I do?"
"Once we're inside, just watch. Don't touch anyone unless they attack you. Hellion law is complicated, and it's going to take us a while to explain what will and won't get you into trouble. Stick close to Cook."
Something popped up on Serpentine's display.
"They're going now."
She angled her Gladig so he could watch. The image showed a big red metal door set in a black stone wall. Clemson neurotically noted that it would violate Panthropolian fire code by opening inward instead of outward. Soulcatcher dragged Teddy Bear onto the scene with a painful-looking grip on her upper arm. When they reached the door, Teddy Bear twisted out of Soulcatcher's grasp and tried to run for it. Soulcatcher grabbed one of her black, silky pigtails and she screamed. He spun her around and backhanded her with an exclamation that didn't need translation. She bounced off the door and fell to the ground.
"That's our cue," Serpentine announced.
She pulled on a pair of goggles and a smooth white helmet, then jumped on his back. He put his helmet back on. The distant hum of traffic dropped out of existence. Colors shifted crazily, then everything went dark and silent. Clemson lifted one of his hands, feeling resistance as if he were buried in dried snow. A sense of claustrophobia crept up, and he sucked in a breath. Serpentine's voice spoke through his ear jack.
"Don't try to walk until I tell you to, and don't yell. Our frame is 1,000 times the speed of the rest of the world. Everything will have more momentum, but less gravity. Make sense?"
Clemson ran it through his mind.
"I think so."
His voice echoed through his helmet as if he were buried, but he didn't have trouble breathing.
"Close enough. It's going to take practice. When I bring us back down to the normal frame, start jogging. Once you're moving, I'll bring our rate up again. It'll be like hitting a wall of air, so be ready."
"Got it. Where to?"
"Across the street from the door, but for now just try not to fall down."
The world rushed back, filling Clemson's senses. He leaned into a brisk jog, but then colors crawled down the spectrum, blue to green, yellow went red, and then black. A purple haze appeared, obscuring the distance. Air piled up in front of him like he was running against a stiff wind. Around the halfway point, his foot slid out from under him, unable to maintain enough traction to push the air. He fell slowly, though, and had no trouble catching himself. As he approached the specified point, Serpentine said,
"Slow down now. Don't wait."
Slowing his pace was easy, but then the air in his wake caught up, pushing him forward. He turned sideways and spread his stance to keep his balance, but the air still pushed him an extra 6 feet, his boots scraping across the pavement. He came to a stop facing where Soulcatcher and Teddy Bear stood. Teddy Bear leaned on the wall next to the door, and Soulcatcher stood with his fists on his hips, both frozen in their contentious vignette. The tableau looked like it had been painted by the colorblind. The door between them was open a crack. "Here's the fun part," Serpentine spoke through his ear jack. "I'm going to drop our frame to almost normal, and you're going to sprint at the door. I'll bring it up again, so expect the resistance to rise. Get as much speed as you can. Before you get to the door, turn left and run around Soulcatcher. Not too close. Now go." The world brightened, and Clemson pushed off the curb into a run. The air resistance pushed back almost immediately, but he was ready for it. By the time they were halfway across the street, he was running in the dark. Serpentine turned on a tiny spotlight, but a thick fog obscured everything. As he passed Soulcatcher, Clemson felt like he was running through water, and his boots threw gravel in his struggle for traction. He turned as instructed, letting his wake flow past him. Serpentine commanded, "Stop!" and the world returned to normal as Serpentine unfolded herself from his back. A column of debris-speckled air slammed into the door, ripping it off its hinges. Serpentine vanished with a crack, leaving a dotted blue-red blur curving through the air into the building. She must have been moving so fast that she had to swim through the air. Teddy Bear preceded Soulcatcher into the building. Cook came jogging from across the street.
"Head in. They should mop up quickly, but they'll expect us to guard the door."
It took Clemson a hot minute to sort out the screaming chaos that filled the interior of the building. A pair of quad-rudder daemons, not much bigger than sparrows, flew in behind them and took up perches on opposite sides of the room. Teddy Bear stood above the room on a platform of nothing. A chatter of machine gun fire rattled from a balcony, and bullet-sized dots appeared in the air around her. Cook pulled out a long pistol and put a hole through the gunman's head. The loud boom of his hand cannon made Clemson wish he had an earjack in both ears. This drew fire from a couple more positions, but the bullets heading the direction came to a stop 10 feet away as if plowing through invisible wood. Cook picked off the gunman calmly, confidently, not wasting a shot. Soulcatcher had removed his jacket and twisted it into a makeshift whip. Someone threw a punch at him, but Soulcatcher dodged and smacked the man's wrist with a sleeve, then whipped it around another man's ankle, connecting the two with a black cord. The first man threw another punch at Soulcatcher, but the black cord stopped his swing and pulled the other guy off his feet. Soulcatcher flowed between his adversaries, dodging and redirecting their blows as if they were choreographed. When the gunfire stopped, the offending bullets clattered over workbenches and the cement floor. Teddy Bear ran across her invisible platform and leapt up to a second-floor mezzanine. Cook indicated a pair of four-legged daemons that trundled through the doorway.
"Those are ours."
A layer of supplies lay across the daemons' backs. Clemson's toolbox trotted around the daemons and planted itself against a nearby wall. A white bolt strobed a jagged path out of the door on the second floor and into another, followed by a cloud of paper. That must be Serpentine. A mob at the far end of the building-spanning room fought each other for the opportunity to escape out the back door. Clemson asked Cook, "Should we try to stop them?"
"Nope."
Cook stood and watched for new targets with the bored diligence of a crossing guard.
"They know who we are. We're letting them opt out. You'll see."
Cook's demeanor hadn't changed, but the environment made him seem relaxed by comparison. Soulcatcher's tangle of opponents tightened almost comically, with the attacker's efforts contributing to their own constraint. Serpentine appeared in front of them, holding out a hand to Cook, then vanished before he could react. The pressure wake from her passing sucked boxes off the table. Cook pulled a white backpack out of his black one and moved to toss it, but it vanished into a blur before it left his hand.
"My bad," he commented. "Nutrition bars. She must have been searching the place for hours already. I usually pass the backpack to her after I play locomotive."
Teddy Bear came flying over the railing of the second floor mezzanine, yelling,
"Palladian!"
A table and cabinet flew after her, but she changed course midair to avoid it, swooped around the room as if she were sliding on ice, then landed on an invisible platform. The furniture crashed into the workbenches below. Cook holstered his pistol, went down on one knee, and unlimbered a carbine from his back. When a man appeared at the railing, Cook burped an explosive stream of small-caliber lead at him. The bullet struck the man's chest and just stopped, then fell to the ground.
"Yep," he commented. "Palladian."
Clemson grabbed a web grenade, but Cook put a hand on his.
"They've got this."
The attacker jumped over the railing and hit the lower floor without a sound, without even bending his knees. He just stopped. It looked wrong.
"The Palladian mages absorb impact," Cook explained. "They store energy and put it into launching things."
Teddy Bear dropped from her perch and looped back at him. The man swung a haymaker at her, but she flipped and landed a kick on his forehead. He seemed to ignore the blow while she stopped cold and dropped to the ground, rolling out of his way. The Palladian stepped toward her but ran into an invisible wall. He punched it, and nearby workbenches skidded a few inches. Soulcatcher stepped forward, snapping the cuff of his sleeve under the man's nose. The man stepped back and crouched, rubbing his face. He grabbed something small and metallic from the floor and held it up between himself and Soulcatcher. The object zipped away, shooting through the space where Soulcatcher's head was a moment before.
"You have to keep them away from things they can throw," Cook explained, "and use soft combat forms."
Soulcatcher snapped his jacket and took abortive jabs. The kineticist took the punching game more seriously, but Soulcatcher never seemed to be where the man's fist was. When the Palladian overcommitted a punch, Soulcatcher threw him skidding into an open area. While the kineticist regained his footing, Serpentine strode past, taking a few steps in fast time, then dropping into normal time for an instant, leaving a red-blue flash of light. The man took a few jabs at her afterimages while she ran circles around him. Everything within 10 feet of the man shot away from him at once. Soulcatcher stepped in, smacking the man's face and arms with his jacket. The kineticist yelled and threw punches but failed to connect. Soulcatcher rolled, coming up behind the man, and smacked the man's legs. The Palladian turned to face Soulcatcher but tripped over the cord that now connected his ankles. As he fell forward, Soulcatcher captured one of his arms with his jacket, driving him into a face plant, then sat on the Palladian's back. Scowling, Soulcatcher produced another black cord from his jacket and wrapped it around the man's neck, tying it tight. The man fought to remove the cord or dislodge Soulcatcher from his back, but had no leverage. Clemson watched until the man passed out, but even then Soulcatcher didn't remove the cord.
"He's going to kill him?"
Soulcatcher stood, and Serpentine blurred past, depositing a clear tarp over the man's body.
"We prefer to think of it as only cutting his life short by the unconscious parts," he stated flatly. "You'll understand in," he checked his wrist gladig, 15 minutes.
Clemson watched, frozen in horror, remembering the captain of the Jezebel.
"This place is fucked up."
"Nobody's arguing."
The kineticist exploded, covering the inside of the tarp with red.
"Palladian mages store their energy in their center of mass," Cook explained calmly. "It all escapes when they die."
Serpentine yelled from the balcony.
"Found it!"
Teddy Bear barked a command at the daemons and ran up invisible stairs to the second floor.
"You go ahead," Cook said. "I'll watch the door."
Clemson followed the pack daemons up the normal stairs into an area populated by culturally nonspecific desks. Teddy Bear stood next to one of them, examining a white box the size of a loaf of bread.
"Tenobian systems, but it should have standard nanoprocessors."
She gestured for Clemson to come over.
"Can you cut the top off of this box?"
She pulled out a marker and drew a line.
"It'll save me a step."
She clipped a metal brick around the cord that attached the box to the wall, and the cord beyond it fell away.
"Do you want me to lop it off or cut through the box?"
"The second, no deeper than 1/2 inch.
"Easy enough."
His bequest centered around building things, but it had an odd effect on the tools he used. They didn't wear out. They wore in. Knives grew sharper as he used them, ropes grew stronger, wrenches reshaped themselves over time to improve their grip. He whistled to his toolbox, and it handed him an extreme case, a cutting tool formed while he was trapped in an oubliette, surviving on the bugs and rats that came too close. It started out as a patch of cloth covered in soot, attached to the end of a stick. He'd twirled the stick so that the cloth rubbed against the manacles, knowing that it would rub through them in times that could only be described as geological. In a matter of days, the stick had reshaped itself into a doll. The cloth had rounded and stiffened, and the soot had migrated to the edge and crystallized into an abrasive. Thus armed, he cut through the manacles in mere weeks. By then, the shaft had absorbed the iron from the manacles and felt more like metal than wood. The cast iron grate that had been hammered into place over the whole of his prison took longer. In that eternity of darkness, the stick transformed into a complicated geared mechanism that drove an abrasive diamond-edged disc to spin at high speeds when he squeezed it. He still hadn't figured out how it could have gotten that way, but he liked it. It cut through the sheet metal box like butter. When the top came off, Clemson peered into it with the glee of a kid opening gifts, but found the contents incomprehensible. Numerous cylindrical doodads stuck out of a fractal-shaped green plate. Teddy Bear set a small box on the green plate. The box crawled across the surface, wiggled a little, then settled down. She connected a cord between the tiny box and her glad egg, then piled it all into Serpentine's waiting arms. Serpentine blurred, then vanished. Gusts of wind rose, and nutrition bar wrappers appeared out of nowhere to be dragged around the office with paper and debris. Teddy Bear wandered off to the railing and peeked down into the room where Soulcatcher and Cook were searching. Clemson inhaled to ask a question, but Serpentine reappeared before Teddy Bear, announcing, "That took forever." Her hair hung in oily strands, and dark circles weighed down her eyes. The shorter woman examined the glad egg, then pronounced,
"It took what it took. We got it."
She disconnected her equipment from the box and Serpentine threw the box into the back of the room. Cook bellowed,
"Time to go."
Hellions in gray uniforms started to pile into the room below. Serpentine zipped past them and Clemson followed Teddy Bear out. Across the street from the factory, white tables and chairs had been laid out next to their bus like a street cafe. Jotun and Serpentine lounged in chairs that looked like balloon sculptures. This seemed like an odd time to relax. Teddy Bear asked,
"What's with the chairs? I'm pretty sure they don't need an audience."
"Have a seat," Jotun pronounced. "The builder needs to watch this."
Serpentine patted the chair next to her.
"She is right," she told Clemson.
"If we waited until later, you'd hate us for hiding it."
He eased his armored bulk into a balloon chair, and Cook took the next one.
"Would you like to tell me what I'm in for?" Clemson asked.
Jotun rolled in with all the emphasis of a school marm.
"As you know, everyone has a credit balance based on their contribution to society. Here," she set a glad egg on the table. "This is yours. It comes with your indenture. Don't lose it. You'll be able to track your balance on it."
Clemson picked up the glass and metal brick. It lit up in his hand, displaying words he couldn't read.
"What does this have to do with the tables and chairs?"
The Hellions led the surviving workers out and lined them up on the street on their knees, their hands fastened behind their backs. Jotun continued as if ticking things off a list.
"Entry to hell is illegal. Anything illegal incurs debt. Killing someone incurs a penalty equal to a percentage of their net worth."
She paused and Clemson nodded.
"If a person's net worth is negative, then the penalty becomes a bounty. You'll notice that the prisoners don't have necklaces."
Jotun waved her hand.
"That means they entered hell illegally and won't have a balance until they're scanned, at which point their balance is negative. Oh, look, it's time to get paid."
A Hellion in a red suit walked up to the line of workers. Serpentine took one of Clemson's hands and Cook took the other. Clemson tensed, realizing what was coming. The red suit pulled the worker's head back and waved his glad egg over the man's face. He consulted the glad egg's display, then unholstered a pistol and splattered the man's brains across the pavement behind him. Clemson watched with horror as they killed them one by one.
Chapter 6. Communion. They rode the bus in silence. Clemson didn't know where they were going, but it didn't matter. He felt a familiar sense of emotional constipation, all the feelings and reactions tangled inside him, getting in each other's way trying to get out, but bottled by his need to avoid reactions that others could use against him. How far did this surveillance go? The stone and glass canyons provided little distraction from the simmering disquiet of watching those people die. He accepted the hexweed pipe when it was passed around. The bus entered a tunnel and rolled to a stop in an underground garage. While a large service elevator took them up and up and up, he determined that Hell used a base 10 numbering system, and they were let off on the 160-somethingth floor. They must be in one of the spires. A cluster of people in blue jackets greeted them. Soulcatcher addressed a man who wore a full-body mechanical prosthetic and a hat like a huge mushroom.
"Dr. Rickman, thank you for meeting us at the door, but we must delay our debrief until tomorrow to allow our newest member time to acclimate."
Rickman's eyes flicked between the six of them, and he pursed his lips. The four mechanical eyes embedded in his hat set a new standard for creepy.
"If you insist. Just forget that we've been standing around for half an hour while you watched immigration clean up. Let's do this in the morning, shall we?"
He turned to the waiting crew.
"They're out for the evening. Reconvene in 10 hours.
Soulcatcher put a hand on his chest and bowed without a hint of sarcasm.
"Thank you. I'm off duty."
Jotun glared at Clemson.
"Don't leave without me."
She followed Rickman's crew, asking,
"Who's responsible for allocating quarters?"
Rickman stared daggers at Clemson as Soulcatcher led him down a hallway.
"Don't mind him. He's got a lot going on."
The bland beige hallways almost made him start asking questions, but then a huge pair of metal doors closed behind them. They entered a side room, 10 by 20, with shiny black walls. A 3-foot-high platform occupied the far half of the room. When Teddy Bear poked at a display, a 5-lobed space in the center of the platform dropped away and filled with water. The other children disrobed in eerie silence, stripping down to their necklaces. Clemson wondered why Cook's necklace was red while the rest of theirs were green. Serpentine interrupted his musings by asking,
"You aren't body shy, are you?"
"Yes, actually I am."
He locked down his unease and started unclasping his armor.
"I'll manage."
Cook and Teddy Bear both showed the idealized muscular physique that children achieved when they pushed themselves, but Clemson's morphology went beyond that. Maybe this was just his insecurities reshaping what he saw in a mirror, but he suspected that his bequest counted his body as a tool. A couple of centuries of tool optimization had left him with a form that he felt could be described as freakish. Nonetheless, he allowed them to help him out of his armor and join them in the pool. The platform was made of thousands of rods that could be independently raised or lowered. When he lay down between Serpentine and Teddy Bear, the pool adjusted to fit his contours. He could feel water flowing between the rods at his back. Serpentine wrapped her hand around his and squeezed. Pulsed, actually, in a way that gave him a headache. She spoke to him through those pulses, and the gift of tongues translated.
"Relax. Lie back. Keep your eyes closed. Take Teddy Bear's hand. They can't eavesdrop this way."
He took Teddy Bear's hand, and she immediately pulsed.
"Are you doing all right? This has to be traumatic. I'm so glad we finally get to talk. The silence was getting oppressive."
He agreed. Serpentine continued,
"Stretch your legs out. Let the guys tap your feet."
He did so, and they exchanged idiomatic greetings. Clemson decided to get straight to the point.
"Privacy, fantastic," he pulsed to Serpentine. "What the fuck is going on?"
The other's appendages quivered in a way that his gift interpreted as laughter.
"That's the right attitude," Teddy Bear squoze. "Quick tutorial, then questions. Pulse to all limbs so we don't have to relay. If we clench like this,"
his hands and feet all tightened for a count of 3,
"then stop talking. We'll teach you the full protocol over time."
"I'm not sure I'm up for the job of political goon squad," Clemson blurted.
"Don't worry," Soulcatcher responded. "We only take those jobs if we have an ulterior motive. Even then, killing is supposed to be optional, but our opponents have a high opt-in rate. Once they opt in, we're just negotiating when." "Like I said," Serpentine added, "our primary job is socializing. Here, that means spying and meddling in politics, that kind of thing. Everything else is window dressing. We have to stay respectable."
Cook picked up the narrative.
"Life your accounting skullduggery sometimes happens when the balance comes out positive, but there's too much petty propaganda and misdirection for that to be a functional habit. Everyone wants to point you at their enemies."
Life your accounting. Clemson hadn't heard that term since he'd left Zauberton. There were too many exceptions to the idea that you could judge a man's guilt by the number of years he took off of the lives of others, but its math was always a good starting point. Clemson asked,
"Does Victor sponsor your side activities?"
"She maintains plausible deniability," Soulcatcher responded, "but would hang us out to dry if anybody complained. Don't discuss it with her. Same for Jotun. Whatever title Jotun possesses, she's Victor's tool."
Teddy Bear interrupted.
"Rickman's different. He knows what we're doing before we do. That guy's the 6th smartest people in the universe and never lets anyone forget it. Fortunately, he isn't culpable, so he just considers it an entertaining part of the job."
While Clemson tried to figure out the last comment, Serpentine asked,
"Are you really here looking for your mule?"
"Basically. It has my map of the portals, among other things. And I was pissed off that the pirates could get away with it so easily. The chance to learn how void ships work was too tempting."
"That's going to be a hard one," Teddy Bear said. "We can find your mule, but the Hellions have wiped out entire cities keeping their void drives secret."
Cook interrupted.
"Does anybody know why the Builder is here?"
Clemson spasmed.
"Didn't I just tell you?"
"You told us why you wanted to be here," Soulcatcher said. "A more important question is why the Hellions want you here."
The world pivoted in Clemson's head, and he saw the events from the Hellion perspective.
"I've been set up."
Of course he had. A rush of anxiety came over him. He stood and hauled himself out of the pool. He stared at the door and relaxed into his gift of passage, casting around for the nearest portal. Trap panic rose with the realization that there were none at all on Hell. Serpentine padded up behind him and touched his arm.
"Are you okay?"
He turned to her, about to say something, then remembered the ubiquitous surveillance thing.
"I just realized something. I haven't had time to actually stop and think since they took my mule. I've been an idiot."
Her eyebrows scrunched with worry, and she gave him a sad smile.
"Everyone gets their turn being an idiot. Come back to the tub."
He consented and rejoined the others. Cook consoled him. "We all fell for it in one way or another. Soulcatcher can read minds, and he's still here."
"I can't read minds," Soulcatcher protested. "I read bodies, but only bodies that are connected to minds. Anything beyond the motor cortex, and I'm running off of sheer theory of mind, same as you." "They had to build a meat puppet to fool him," Serpentine explained. "Organic all the way up to the frontal lobe and remote-controlled from there."
Clemson opened an eye to see if she was smirking.
Teddy Bear dug up the requisition for the Fast Time agency that designed and grew it.
That sounded more extreme than orchestrating a theft of a cargo ship.
"You win. Tell me why I'm here."
"If any of us knew, we'd have said already."
Teddy Bear somehow managed to inflect a peevish tone into her squeezes.
"Don't hold it against Victa. Soulcatcher must have read Clemson's mind on that one. At least not yet. She may have gone along with it just because she's a big fan of yours."
Cook asked, "If Rickman knows everything, do you think he'd tell us?"
"That depends on how many of the Ninth Circle are involved," Soulcatcher replied. "If it's three or more, it becomes subject to the Leviathan Secrecy Accords."
"Victor said she was a baron of the Ninth Circle," Clemson said.
"What does that mean?" The other four exchanged pulses faster than Clemson could interpret, but then Soulcatcher responded,
"Short version.
The top seven Methuselans signed treaties, divvying up control to avoid killing each other off. They're called the Ninth Circle."
"Methuselans?"
"Never been reincarnated," Serpentine clarified. "Leviathan wound up with their equivalent of Minister of Information and Transportation. She developed an information-sharing agreement called the Accords. It keeps them from accidentally working against each other. Now they just do it on purpose."
Cook interrupted,
"We can do some digging about who wants you here, but the current priority is that the Daffodils factories have just tripled their production. That usually means someone's outfitting a militia, but this one's too big for that. When the other shoe drops, we don't want to be underneath its heel, so we're looking into it."
"What are they?" Clemson asked. "Super soldier pills?"
"No, worse," Teddy Bear replied. "Super soldier training is hard to hide, and they don't store well. Daffodils are a cocktail that gives people a special kind of focus. It's used recreationally, but lets some mages imbue their magic into objects. They make invisibility cloaks and telekinesis guns with it."
"Don't overwhelm him," Serpentine chastised.
"We can fill in the details once he has context."
Soulcatcher asked, "How did the data look?"
"Pretty much what we expected," Teddy Bear responded. "Lots of shell companies on the books. It's going to take some serious machine learning to spot a pattern. I'm going to ask Victor to expense some of the transportation records."
In the silence that followed, Clemson lost the contest of waiting for someone else to say something.
"Could I ask a question?"
"Yes," they all replied.
"What's with the weird names? Children always call themselves words that translate well across languages. Soulcatcher, Serpentine, Teddy Bear must be a cultural reference. And I don't know where Blackmore comes from."
A mild chuckle shook his limbs. Serpentine responded,
"It's a Hellion game, all about coding facts with enough shifting layers of truth that the original fact is in dispute. The cultural values seep into everything. I was called Slow Time before I got here. You used to be called Glass, didn't you, Teddy Bear?" "I called myself Wall before that," she replied. "Teddy bears are children's cuddly toys. It tickles me to use their misconceptions against them."
"I've always been Soulcatcher," Soulcatcher said.
The man somehow managed to intone expression into his pulses.
"That was my profession before my people chased me out of town. Something between an actor and an impressionist. It serves me well. Due to ubiquitous surveillance, all the world really is a stage."
"I've been thinking of changing my name," Cook commented. "Maybe change it to Chef."
"Why Chef?"
Clemson thought, but accidentally pulsed.
He explained himself. "I mean, I haven't figured out what your request is."
Communications went quiet long enough for Clemson to worry that he'd insulted someone.
"He's a little sensitive," Soulcatcher sent. "Feels like he drew the short straw."
Clemson wasn't sure if the information was worth pushing for, but Teddy Bear rescued him.
"You know the way your request helps you build things?"
He builds people, nutritionally. He's a super dietitian.
That's understating it, Soulcatcher insisted. He can diagnose most diseases by the vitamin deficiencies he senses, and can cure illness with a walk through a flower garden.
It's okay, Cook broke in. I get more use out of vigor than I do my bequest. Just don't tell anyone. It would seriously cut into my value as a poisoner.
He's kidding, Soulcatcher interrupted. He's not good at inflection with normal speech either.
Clemson filed that away and plunged onward.
What about Blackmore and the Oracle?
Serpentine picked up a role as educator.
I don't know where Blackmore's name came from. He's been here longer than any of us. He used to work with us, but Mammon made him an offer he couldn't refuse. We try to avoid his attention. He's gone a little strange.
I hate to say this, but his stakes are too rich for me, Soulcatcher added. I don't know if we can trust him any longer.
Clemson stiffened. That was the worst condemnation he'd ever heard a child apply to another child.
He's not wrong, Teddy Bear squozed. His bequest involves putting ideas in people's heads. I never know what to believe when I talk to him.
They haven't known him for as long as I have, but I'm on the fence about this too,
Serpentine paused.
We have to use these soaks to cross-reference. He's undeniably effective at reducing societal life here wastage, so I can't claim that what he does is wrong, but his focus on the long game is...
She paused.
Disconcerting, Soulcatcher finished.
And the Oracle?
She's definitely gone strange, but she's nice, Cook responded. She's over a couple thousand years old, and all children seem to get kooky after that.
There's a lot of speculation on how her bequest works, Serpentine said, but it has something to do with remote viewing.
She found me on a fast-time backwater planet, Cook said, and gave me instructions for delivering her terms for coming back. The Hellions have her locked up in a bunker underground, and she seems to be happy with that. You should put off visiting her, though. She can be...
Grumpy,
Teddy Bear suggested.
Yeah, grumpy, Cook continued. She's talked people into suicide in as little as 15 minutes.
Clemson missed the next exchange while he mulled this over.
So what you're telling me, he interrupted, is that the longer I stay here, the more likely I am to become a sociopathic megalomaniac that calls himself the Clemtaminator.
Or a paranoid agoraphobe, Soulcatcher added. Who calls himself the Weaver?
Serpentine finished.
Ooh, ooh, I got one,
Teddy Bear started.
A militant zoning commissioner with...
I think he gets it, Cook interrupted. Before she sent me here, the Oracle warned me about this place feeding on our three curses.
You know this and you don't leave.
Yes, they all pulsed. I am so fucking screwed.
Chapter 7. Initiation. After the conversation wound down, the children insisted that the Daemons would clean his armor and deliver it to his room. They donned fuzzy white house coats and walked out of the spa into a two-story atrium.
This wing is ours.
Serpentine spread her arms and did a twirl.
We have our own security system and blast doors between us and the rest of the building. Daemons do the housework and maintenance.
Cook, Soulcatcher, and Teddy Bear said their goodbyes and exited through two of the atrium's 10 silvery metal doors.
In case you haven't figured it out yet, we've known you were coming for days. Your room is number 9. Wave your gladded gear to unlock it.
When he did so, the door clicked and slid aside. Clemson's tool chest sat in the atrium and followed them in. The high ceiling and walls looked unfinished industrial, but the sparse furnishings were made of wood instead of the textureless material favored here. They were arranged to imitate a drinking establishment and looked oddly familiar. Some tables and chairs, a bookcase, a bar with shelves full of bottles and glasses. Artifacts not entirely from his past covered the surfaces.
We didn't know how to decorate it, so we pulled this from the chronicle of your visit to Luftonshire. Like it?
This is Quink's pub. Luftonshire was a good place. Pity about the sinkhole. You made all of this in a few days?
I worked on the designs for a month and a half my time. Then Rickman's machines assembled them. They only look like wood.
Rickman will try to exact payment in the form of details about your bequest. He picked up a full-size replica of his multi-tool from the clutter on the bar. It was far simpler and made of thin resin.
What are these?
Merchandise. It's your brand, so you have to sign off before they can be sold. This, for instance,
she put her hand on a 3-foot-tall statue of him,
is a prototype of a Clemson the Builder action figure. If you press its skull here, it'll follow you around and quote you to yourself. Quite annoying.
The likeness was definitely not flattering. Tiny replicas of his tool chest and mule also sat on tables, along with numerous things he couldn't identify.
He looked over the bookcase. I don't believe a book ever walked through Quink's door.
He pulled one out and paged through it, but didn't recognize the language. The bindings looked worn, but the pages were crisp. Serpentine went behind the bar and pulled glasses and a bottle from the shelves.
It's a bad replica of the librarian's bookshelf, complete with copies of his mystery books in Hellion Common.
He tried to look behind the bookcase to see if it came with a secret door, but it was attached to the wall.
There's a book near the center in Panthroplion. Wave your gladig over it.
She handed him a half-full glass of amber liquid. He held the glass up to the light.
Zabratan whiskey?
Cook's blend, far better.
When he waved his gladig over the book entitled Animal Farm, the bookshelf slid towards him into one side, revealing a smaller room, about 8x12. The only furnishings were a bed, a chest of drawers, and a small table.
Heated bedroom?
We've adopted the Hellion tradition of sleeping in a secure space.
She walked in and waved her hands around.
It's like a tiny void ship without the engines. Full isolation.
She touched a button on the table, and an inner door slid open, revealing a Panthroplion-style compact hygiene facility. He ordered his tool chest into the room.
Is the room surveillance-proof?
No room on the planet is secure from all surveillance.
She smiled and stroked her green necklace.
But close enough that we can pretend. Do you mind if I sleep here tonight?
He tensed as their casual social near-nudity turned intentional. He'd never figured out how relationships were supposed to work. Sometimes he'd get comfortable with someone, but then some inexplicable shift would ruin things, leaving him scarred for a decade. He retreated into blunt clarification.
Do you mean sex?
She smiled and traced nothings on the floor with her toe.
It's not required, but it would make me happy.
She brushed his lower lip with her finger, pointing out that he'd left it agape. If she weren't one of the children, he'd be certain she was trying to scam him, but children just didn't think that way.
Shouldn't we get to know each other first?
She sat on the bed.
We could have a relationship, but then I'd have to fight Teddy Bear over you.
Teddy Bear too? Are pickings really that thin here?
He immediately realized how rude that sounded.
I'm sorry, I mean...
She laughed a deep snickering snort and rolled back onto the bed.
You have no idea. Hellions, men and women, act like they'd be selling out their birthright if they appreciated you.
She stood and sauntered up to him.
The aliens are willfully ignorant, and the ones that work with the Hellions tend towards schizophrenia. But really...
She put a hand on his shoulder and walked around him, running her hand across his back.
What woman wouldn't want some of this?
He caught his breath and weighed his options. Serpentine would definitely be annoyed if he said no. Not that he wanted to decline... But this was a bad place to fall prey to complications.
What about Cookin's soul catcher?
She blinked, then her eyes widened with feigned innocence. A playful smile spread across her face.
Don't mention it in front of the Hellions, she said in a stage whisper. But they're a couple.
Oh.
Clemson relaxed and let his breath go, relieved by her simple honesty. He pressed the button to close the bedroom's door.
I'm sorry. I'm used to having to sort through people's ulterior motives before letting them get close.
Besides, she was absolutely adorable, and helped him realize how much he needed to relax. Most children couldn't maintain a relationship, but made good friends with benefits. He took her hand and put his other hand on her shoulder and slid it along her neck, cupping her face and caressing her cheek.
You really are what I need right now.
The rest of the night was a lot more of what he needed. She had the emotional confidence born of several lifetimes of relationships. She didn't assign blame when things didn't go perfectly. Their lovemaking shifted from tentative to desperate to sorrowful as she kept pace with the emotional turmoil he usually hid under his armor. They spent subjective months together in the depths of fast time. It only took a couple of weeks. As long as she was touching him and awake, he could share her time frame, so they cuddled in a silent dark bubble while he learned the language and culture. Teddy Bear occasionally joined them in real time, adding a note of manic enthusiasm to their recreation. Clemson had been of the mistaken impression that the two women didn't like each other. The silent depths took some getting used to. Clemson couldn't help but check the shadows every now and again. Outside light didn't exist at the wavelengths they could interact with. At her maximum frame of reference skew, they were seeing X-rays. The air pushed back like cotton, and careless pressure waves from him reaching for something would knock things flying away from him.
The interface provided fresh air, but she had to smoke in real time to prevent it from filling the room. She made smoke sculptures for his entertainment by blowing smoke through a tube, but they didn't last more than a blink before being swept away by the turbulence of their creation. She provided him with an anchor for his gift of tongues while he learned how to read and speak the common language from a Hellion general-purpose computing machine. She introduced him to the wonders of the Hellion Digital Communications Network. Scientific and engineering forums gave him insight into local technology and helped fill in his vocabulary. Once she explained how digital money worked, he found the joys of online shopping. It was glorious. He had to check with her that he was translating correctly when he saw that they'd be delivering his power tools and material samples tomorrow.
"That's right," she said, "but that's 2 weeks away for us."
Serpentine's ability to stay awake was the limit to their ability to stay in slow time. Vigor allowed Clemson to stay awake for around 5 days with declining mental faculties, but Serpentine managed a week without even pushing it. Cook's bespoke nutrition bars helped. They settled into a pattern of 7 days in slow time, then 12 hours of sleep, with Clemson taking power naps as necessary. Clemson had always spent his free time researching something or another, but it always involved building things. That meant dealing with the fugue. The trance-like state suppressed his awareness of things outside of his task, like the passage of time in his surroundings, in favor of things like not cutting his fingers off or calculating how far he could throw something without damaging it. This lapse in attention caused a mental stuttering in his memories. His time with Serpentine was the first time in ages that he didn't feel like he was in a montage. When she resumed running errands, he stayed within the 3 floors of the headquarters. He didn't dare leave the building for fear of expensive legal consequences. Hellion ordinances were a sucker's game, penalizing the unwary for crimes that mostly came down to not being familiar with the ordinances. The jurisdictions with the wackiest justifiable rules drew in the most tax revenue. The mission control room took up 2 floors on the far side of the building. It resembled a gymnasium more than it did the bridge of the Jezebel. Numerous vast displays surrounded a random scattering of tables, chairs, and workstations. The first time Clemson walked into the room, Dr. Rickman squatted on a platform that stood in the center. He had to circle around the platform to figure out how Rickman's powered leg armor acted like a chair, supporting the man in a comfortable-looking crouch. A collection of mismatched displays surrounded him, above and below, resembling a mouthful of crooked molars. Teddy Bear had described the cranial six-pack that Rickman hid under his mushroom-shaped hat. As the leader in the field of genetic fine-tuning of the human brain, Rickman was his own favorite test subject. Clemson found the bulbous-headed Hellion nearly congenial once he'd compartmentalized Rickman's deep disdain for pretty much everybody. The doctor greeted him with a frown.
"Good morning, Builder. Are you enjoying your honeymoon?"
These were his words, anyway. His tone said, "When are you going to be of use to someone instead of just being underfoot?" Clemson ignored the dig.
"I quite am," he replied, raising a wall of cheerfulness. "I hope you're doing well today."
He'd learned to accept the unblinking stare of the mechanical eyes, but the independently moving and blinking biological ones still gave him the willies.
"You don't have to pretend you like me, Clemson. I don't like myself either. That's why I keep trying to improve myself. Thus far, I think I've only made myself more wealthy and insufferable, neither of which would be an improvement to you. Can we at least pretend that it matters? Consider it a diagnostic."
5 of Rickman's eyes swiveled around to fix Clemson with a brief dread stare, then went back to looking over the collection of displays.
"I'm currently annoyed, bored, amused, deeply terrified, and asleep. All of me are too busy for social noises. Why are you here?"
So much for small talk.
"I might be wasting my time, but I have to work with you, so I'm trying to figure out how to annoy you less. I also think you can teach me things to improve homunculi cognition. How does it work for you to have separate emotions? Do you have 6 endocrine systems?"
"Trade secret," Rickman graced him with a mirthless smile. "Besides, your brain would probably break halfway through the explanation.
Try me.
You have no frame of reference for genetically guided neurochemical engineering." While Clemson tried to parse that sentence, Rickman continued, "See what I mean? I'll just stop there." Clemson frowned in resignation. "Point made." He couldn't help but glance at Rickman's hat.
"Can I ask about your eyes? Are those your work?"
One of Rickman's 4 mechanical eyes swiveled to look Clemson over.
"Think of them as aftermarket add-ons. I wouldn't waste my time on something so crude."
No, your artistry is self-evident. Why do you work for Victor?
I don't work for Victor. Clarification. I'm not an employee. We have an arrangement. I serve her purposes, and she provides me with a challenging environment in which to give my iterations a test run. My deformities, he waved a hand in front of his skull, go unnoticed in the presence of the children's parade of peculiarities.
He ignored the slight and decided to fact-check.
Iterations. So you experiment on yourself?
You think I'd give this kind of improvement to someone else?
I'm guessing not. I'm just wondering how you keep your knowledge from one clone to the next.
Rickman's smile didn't frost over this time.
Trade secret.
Clemson smiled back and nodded, then pulled up a chair.
Enough small talk, for real this time. How do I find my mule?
Finally!
Rickman's voice lost its nasal tendencies and took a more clipped cadence. The Void Guard tracked it through the underworld near the southern continent.
It popped up somewhere near the Nemorian-Tesseran border.
We have ships, drones, and satellites searching the area. There aren't a lot of places you can hide a 25,000 cubic meter freighter. I'll let you know when we find something.
That sounds fantastic.
However,
Rickman shifted back to his relaxed tone.
You asked how to find your mule, not how to get it back.
Clemson knew he had a big gap in that area.
I suppose you're going to tell me. I wouldn't turn down advice.
Perhaps not, but it'll take more than advice. We can presume that there's someone else who thinks they own it.
I suppose a smash and grab would be out of the question,
Clemson posited.
I could navigate the issues for you, Rickman suggested lightly. Find it and bring it home.
A familiar chill ran down Clemson's spine.
What would that cost me?
Nothing you wouldn't do anyway. This will just encourage you to take a professional approach. I want you to tell me everything you can about the Machine God.
Clemson realized that there was something that he feared more than the Machine God. A Machine God controlled by a Hellion.
What would you do with the information?
The same thing I do with all information.
Rickman seemed to think that was adequate, but Clemson waited him out.
Fine. My experiments with distributed intelligences haven't progressed past 6 units, but the Machine God somehow manages 20. The knowledge will decrease the number of, let's call them, dead ends I have to go through.
Ah! Rickman didn't know that the Machine God's technique relied upon the participants having individuality before they merged. It probably wouldn't help Rickman, but it still gave Clemson a bargaining chip.
That doesn't sound too malignant. But I'm sure you want more than you can glean from Panthropian textbooks.
Very observant.
Yes, I need to know how you put it all together.
Your world's technical manuals presume cultural foundations that elude me. Remember, your last 1,000 years of advancement have all happened in the past 150 years our time.
You want me to relate the soul of the Thermomechanics Corps. In return, you have to collect the hecatomb anyway, so there isn't much for you to do. How about you throw in teaching me how the Void Drive works?
Rickman's throat spasmed with multiple attempts to laugh simultaneously.
Aren't you the ambitious one? If I gave you that, I'd be legally obligated to kill you. Besides, you won't be here long enough to even absorb the foundations.
There he went with that again. Clemson countered with a goofy smile.
I accept the challenge. The worst I could do is fail.
Several of Rickman's eyes swiveled forward and aside, alternately examining Clemson in the screens.
Very well. I'll give you breadcrumbs. Learn at your own pace. An invitation to educational programs will appear in your Gladig. I recommend you hire someone to read materials to you while Serpentine is off doing her things. Shall we schedule a bout of questions for next week?
Late one night, Serpentine dragged him up to the 200th floor. The elevator doors opened to reveal a space like an art gallery. Glass partitions broke the floor into numerous small spaces, each filled with tables. Clusters of scarlet-skinned Hellions sat around those tables, somberly consuming their meals. A restaurant, even in the middle of the night, half of the tables in the dimly lit room were occupied. Serpentine waved off the maitre d' and led Clemson through the winding forest of transparent walls around the building's core. Once beyond the lobby, Clemson noticed that the walls weren't transparent. Ceiling-to-floor three-vid walls displayed images of the people at the tables, but in the projections they sat still and upright, staring back whenever you looked their way. He shivered and averted his gaze, wondering if hell was intrinsically creepier than other worlds or if something had changed with him. He could hear people muttering as he passed, but even when near he couldn't understand what they were saying.
Between that and the walls, it provided the illusion of being out in public while maintaining privacy. On the other end of the restaurant, they found a horseshoe-shaped table for 20, currently only hosting 6. Cook stood in the center, his steel knife rattling against a cutting board like a woodpecker. They took a pair of open chairs next to Soulcatcher. Soulcatcher shifted in his seat to face them.
"About time you brought him here." Serpentine smiled. "We've been busy. He's still learning, but this place is relatively safe. Besides, he needs to be introduced to Cook's cuisine."
Cook set 2 tiny cups in front of Clemson, 1 white and 1 black.
"Here's the first page of your menu. Pick one."
He put an identical pair in front of Serpentine, then went back to frying mushrooms. Serpentine shot the contents of the black cup, took a bite of cracker, then shot the white one. She compared the weight of the 2 cups, then set the white one down in front of her, and the black one upside down to the right. The black cup held a salty broth, and the white one contained a sweet tea. He set the white one aside.
"How does this work?" "He is testing your palate," Soulcatcher said. "Your choices determine what you eat."
Clemson scanned the racks of fresh vegetables hung behind a row of pots and pans, and bins of tubers stowed under the countertops. Cook swept the declined cups into a machine and set a new pair in front of them, gray and red this time. Both Clemson and Serpentine selected the bland gray water over the spicy red liquor. Before he set the red cup aside, Clemson held it up and asked,
"What's with the red faces? Is that a Hellion makeup trend?"
Everyone at the table immediately hushed and looked his way. Soulcatcher took an imperious stance and gesticulated at the group across the table, scowling fiercely.
"Cool your heels! He's fresh off a void ship, and it's an honest question."
A couple of them looked offended, but they all returned to their conversation, now turned to gibberish. Soulcatcher turned back to Clemson.
"Touchy subject.
The red is a side effect of their immortality treatments. Every time they get one, the residue accumulates in their dermis. The older they get, the redder they get.
They're self-conscious about it. Good thing I didn't ask Victor."
She would have just laughed. They figured out how to remove the taint centuries ago, but by then it was a status symbol. Only the longest-lived get to wear that color. This makes it an obvious target for racial slurs, like insulting royalty for the genetic side effects of inbreeding. Cook placed a new pair of cups in front of Clemson, blue and yellow, this time different from the pair offered to Serpentine. Clemson asked,
"How do they know what I was saying? I was speaking Panthropian."
He selected the umami broth over a sweet-sour paste. Serpentine tasted the contents of her purple cup and wrinkled her nose.
"Global translators. Hell gets 100 new languages a year. Not even Rickman could keep up.
The network offers instantaneous machine translation. You can subscribe to services that'll provide the languages of everyone near you.
It's also a good clue about how the system knows where you are. The translations aren't very good, but red and skin are universal."
"Important thing to know."
Clemson felt sick at the thought of what the machine god could do with that.
"Is that all surveillance-based, or do they tap into our necklaces?"
"They don't need the necklaces. Your Gladig spies on you as if it were doing you a favor and charges you for it as a service,"
Serpentine added. "Fortunately, this place has audio scramblers." Soulcatcher took another bite of his braised tubers and talked while he chewed.
"Has she shown you the sports feeds?"
Clemson grimaced.
"I don't usually sports the sports balls."
Cook swept in and placed new cups, 2 different shades of green, in front of him. Neither held meaningful flavor, but the lighter green contained a smooth gelatin, while the other a crunchy bread cube. He picked the gelatin. Soulcatcher chuckled and swallowed.
"It's not just sports. It's required viewing for xenoarchaeologists. All races build competitions around their magic, and it usually defines their limitations."
"Interesting. I've seen that on the slow time worlds, but never thought of how video feeds would affect it. Do they compete cross-culture?"
"The Palladians and the Nemorians have a sport that requires some of each. The big draw at the moment is Palladian punch-fests. After they hit their energy cap, they start knocking each other around an arena full of obstacles and targets. Fun to watch."
To Clemson's relief, the group across from them packed up, relinquishing the space. "My favorite is the Naquin wave races. They repel water and can hover above any body of water big enough to displace their weight. They fly like missiles, skimming the tips of waves and doing ballets with smoke trails during intermissions."
Cook dropped a plate before Serpentine, announcing,
"Zucchini lasagna and a tomato base with a wheat and lentil interleave."
She didn't hesitate to slice a chunk off with a fork and stuff it in her mouth, and then smiled beatifically.
"Wonderful, thank you."
With a flourish, Cook slid a plate and a bowl before Clemson.
"Eggplant jubilee with a side of soup. May your appetite serve you well."
At first, Clemson felt let down.
His initial impression was maybe a touch off of a tomato cream sauce, but as he rolled it around his tongue, other flavors flared to life. Tomato and basil had a chive driven between them, making them resonate. A wisp of salt lassoed a bit of cayenne and whipped it forward to explode across the roof of his mouth. A crackling of red pepper shimmered across his palate, then sparkled away. He took another bite, but didn't get the same experience as the flavors mushed together.
"That's amazing. Your bequest lets you do that?"
"No, my bequest is like yours. No consideration for aesthetics. This is just 600 years of culinary expertise. I was a chef before I was a child." He sipped the soup, but there was nothing special about the savory broth. It was a letdown, but then he tried the eggplant again for another round of culinary explosions. Beautiful. He held up a forkful of the layered dish.
"Tell me something. Why is hell so vegetarian?"
Cook's well-groomed eyebrows arched with resignation as he reached into a pocket.
"Hedged down for 2 months," Cook growled.
He plunked the coin in front of Serpentine. Another coin slid past him into Serpentine's grasp.
"I thought it would take you at least 3 weeks,"
Soulcatcher looked apologetic. Clemson searched their faces for the punchline.
"What am I missing?"
Cook crossed his arms.
"Have you tried to raise cattle 50 miles from a war zone? That's most of the planet. There are two kinds of meat in Malabolge. The unaffordable kind grazes under a nuclear-powered sun in deep caves."
Clemson recognized a pregnant pause when he heard it.
"Do they have a blob of chicken muscle that they shave pieces off of?"
"No. Think cheaper. Like a perpetually renewed resource."
He leaned across the bar and spoke softly, not breaking eye contact.
"On hell, it rains meat."
Clemson knit his eyebrows and stared at Cook, trying to determine if he was serious. Cook didn't flinch. Serpentine wore her "something is up" smirk. He glanced at Soulcatcher, but the man's eyes were fixed on his glad egg. They were seeing how long it would take him to figure it out.
"Like literally falling out of the sky?"
They probably already told him, but he hadn't put it together. Serpentine responded,
"We don't know where they actually fall out of."
"They?
Oh, cannibalism?"
Serpentine slid Soulcatcher's coin back to him.
"And they're all okay with it?"
Soulcatcher put away his gladig.
"Call them an unpersecuted minority. How do they manage the diseases?"
Victor had mentioned why they didn't give shore leave to the non-Hellions.
"They don't have to."
Cook wiped down the surfaces and implements as he talked.
"When people are raptured to hell, it fixes things. Bones knit, spines straighten, every disease, malady, and inconvenient variation removed, from dementia all the way up to pregnancy.
I don't know if cannibalism was intended, but it was inevitable." Clemson took another bite of Jubilee, but no longer tasted it.
"Intended? You think someone is doing it on purpose?"
Cook shrugged. "It adds up too neatly. I can see people getting swept through the void via natural vortices, but health optimization is too convenient to be natural."
"I suppose it's a functional theory, but I'll take natural processes over agency any day. This rapture thing might just be simplifying people in the translation. I was working on the idea that hell was a phage latrine, that they pooped out people here if they accidentally ingested one. Vigor might be a side effect of their digestive process. Maybe phages are smart."
Cook raised his hands and shrugged.
"Maybe. I'm interested in what happens to the other 3 out of 4. Maybe hell gets its universe's rejects, or maybe they're the only ones that survive the transfer."
He left to clean up the other side of the space. Clemson finished his plate.
"Well, regardless, I'm a vegetarian for the duration."
Cook presented a resigned smile.
"Welcome to the club."
Soulcatcher sat back in his chair.
"It isn't the eating that bothers me. It's that some take pride in it. The surest sign of depravity is when mankind's worst barbarisms are practiced with sophistication."
You have reached the end of the preview of Dystopia, Clemson Goes to Hell. If you enjoyed it, send an email to Clemson at thawmechanicalman.com. The first 100 people to do so will receive a free copy of the full audiobook when it's released. Feel free to distribute this demo to any and all who you think might enjoy it. This has been an Ankh Infinity production.